You are listening to the Outlaw Nation on the Fringe Radio Network. FringeRadioNetwork.com. Your hosts, Eric and Chris, are not responsible for your safety.
Welcome to Outlaw Nation with your hosts, Eric and Chris. You're listening to the Fringe Radio Network. You can find us on FringeRadioNetwork.com/category/outlaw. You can also reach us at our new email address if you have a question or if you want to contact us about anything. It's outlawnation7@gmail.com, and I'll repeat some of that information at the end of the podcast. So welcome to Outlaw Nation. Chris, thanks for coming, and our topic today is going to be alchemy, and primarily practical alchemy. We were trying to think of what is the most fringe topic we could talk about. This is kind of our debut episode on the Fringe Radio Network, so we wanted to, you know, pick something that wasn't in the mainstream, and I don't think alchemy is in the mainstream. Would you say that, Chris?
Well, I don't think our alchemy that we're going to be talking about is in the mainstream.
Right. And you know, it's kind of funny, because
we can elaborate on that.
Lately, you know, there's been a lot more alchemy in social media and in movies lately than really any other time that I've seen, you know, with the Harry Potter films and things like that. So kind of a fun subject. We're just going to talk about that subject for the next couple hours, and I hope you enjoy it. So one of the things we wanted to just start with is just the definition of alchemy. You know, what does that word mean? Where does it come from? And there are actually several different forms of historical alchemy. And then, on the other hand, there is also a lot of misunderstanding what alchemy is, and that has kind of morphed in modern day into these different interpretations of what alchemy is. But really, the term alchemy is, you know, kind of where we get the term chemistry. But the etymology of that word alchemy is kind of really unknown. Some people think it's from a chem, which right. is Egyptian for the black art.
Black soil, they say, too.
Yep.
Of Egypt, yeah.
Totally makes sense. It's also Greek is chemi, which means infusion.
Hmm.
So there are some people that say it's an amalgam between sal, which would be kind of a Greek root for salt, and the salt of infusion.
That'd make sense.
Yeah, I mean, there are terms like that. The whole idea of a chimera, you know, kind of has that same sense. So there's symbolism
right.
between the chimera too. Some of these monsters of the ancient myths were used by alchemists to describe their art, and they chose
right.
them for specific reasons. Sometimes they even made monsters to describe their art. So that, like the chimera with the different heads, we can go into the symbolism of that. So kind of what we're going to do is not just talk about definitions and things like that, but we're also going to talk about my personal journey with alchemy, some of the experiments I've done. You know, if you're an alchemist, you should be pretty familiar with failure, and that's really not why you do it, because, you know, one of the subjects you'll run across real fast is what is the Philosopher's Stone? What does that consist of? And, you know, that's the ultimate goal of the great work. And so we'll talk about some of those things, but know that, you know, there are very few people that claim to have done that. And so the journey with alchemy is almost as important as the final goal. You know, so anyways, alchemy in its rudest sense, or its basest sense, is really about transformation. And some of the books we're going to talk about, and one of the guys that I have kind of come to lean on quite a bit, and I go back to, and I've read these books over and over for 20 years. One is called Fulcanelli, or it's by Fulcanelli. It's called Le Mystery de Cathedral, or The Mystery of the Cathedrals by Fulcanelli. The other one is The Dwellings of the Philosophers, which I think is kind of a more complete work, also written by Fulcanelli. And Fulcanelli is kind of a mysterious character. You know, he kind of came on the scene of, late in the 19th century. He had a disciple named Eugene Cancelet. And supposedly the story is that Fulcanelli gave these manuscripts to Eugene to publish. And every time Eugene saw him, he looked younger and younger. And this was a guy in his 70s. And then next time he saw him, he looked like he was in his 60s and his 50s. And, you know, so if he achieved this idea of, you know, the Philosopher's Stone and was able to reverse his age, then that's what the possibility is there that Eugene observed. But we don't really know. And there, and even upon the initiation of nuclear fusion, there was a person that was shown around a facility where they were doing some experiments on, you know, like the nuclear experiments. And this guy claimed that he was Fulcanelli, and, you know, he was asking them a lot of questions, and he had a lot of insights that these guys didn't even really know about. So there's separating truth from fiction with when it comes to stories about Fulcanelli is tough. But those are some of the things around this mysterious character. Supposedly he retreated from society and is still alive and living up, you know, somewhere in Austria in the mountains. I mean, who knows? So, but there's a lot of mysterious characters associated with alchemy. You know, like Saint Germain was supposedly associated with alchemy. But one of the books I just mentioned, Fulcanelli, The Mystery of the Cathedrals, you know, he talks about what alchemy is. And I really like his take on it because it kind of dispels the notion of this kind of spiritual mishmash you're hearing about in, you know, on the internet and people that think they know about alchemy. They tend to get these fanciful ideas of what alchemy is, and it's not really based on anything historical.
Right.
So one of the things that he says in his book is that it's really the science of energy transformation, and that's, or transmutation, if you want to use those words interchangeably. And that's why people will refer to winemaking as kind of a process of alchemy, you know, nuclear decay as a process of alchemy. And this is also why you've seen division historically with different alchemical traditions. So what we're going to talk about is primarily Western practical alchemy. I'll come back to that in a second. But, you know, back around, oh, I don't know, 300 AD, I think, is where we're starting kind of the historical record of some of the alchemists. And to be honest with you, one of my failings is I don't know these personages by their history or by, you know where they lived and who they were and their kind of their biography. I mean, even Fulcanelli, you could see I wasn't, you know, I know a little bit about him, but I'm not like that interested in his life. I'm more interested in what they knew. And so I focused on what they said, not on really who they were. And and through comparison over the years, I think I had a better idea of who really knew what they were talking about and who was just basing their ideas on past alchemists. So Fulcanelli, you get the sense when you read his books that he not only knew what the stone was, but had achieved it. And there are others like Artifius or Paracelsus that you get that sense too, that they're hiding something. They're speaking in symbols and they're not being clear at times. Sometimes they're crystal clear. They want to obscure something. That's another thing about alchemy. It's only obscure because it's hidden. It's a phrase you'll run across a lot. It's not obscure because it's, you know, not a real science or anything. The people that know about it, I think they've obscured it purposely. But really it started, you know, about 300 AD. And when we're really getting into the bulk of the historical information, you're hitting around 1200 to 1600 and even 1700 AD. But there was definitely this split between Eastern and Western alchemy. The Western alchemists were definitely more of a practical nature, lab work. They thought of the Philosopher's Stone as something solid and physical.
External.
External, exactly. The inner alchemists, the Eastern inner alchemy, there was definitely an Eastern practical alchemy, don't get me wrong. I think their information's harder to read. I think the Western alchemists are easier to kind of go through their symbolism and, you know, and I think the documents are harder to get a hold of too in the Eastern tradition. The inner alchemy, there are some really good books on that. I know a little bit about it, but really what it was about was moving energy internally in the body. And
right.
So there are some good books. Eric Udlove has a good book called Taoism and the Tree of Life. That's an excellent primer if you want to learn a little bit about inner alchemy. The reason I never really went down that path is it seems like you need a really experienced teacher to mm-hmm. achieve anything significant. And it takes a lot of dedication. I mean, you're doing this. It's kind of like, you know, working out with weights. You got to do it every day.
You really have to be in the right kind of conditions too, environmental conditions that I think aren't really conducive where we're at, you know.
Right. And for me, what was the payoff? I mean, if you enjoy that kind of study and you want to practice that, that is where I think you see a lot of the internet alchemy focused too. You see people talking about inner transformation, and you see people talking about – some people will talk about traditional Taoism and the movement of this energy. That's what Montauk Chia's work is all about. He wrote about, I don't know, 5 or 6 books on the movement of chi inside the body. Mm-hmm. And then there's this kind of this psychological alchemy that's also developed more recently. It kind of uses Jungian archetypes.
That's the popular one.
Go ahead.
That's the popular one.
Yeah, yeah. And then there is another kind of alchemy that I call it a mystical alchemy or a spiritual alchemy. And I think that's more of a grab bag, to be honest with you. It's really New Agey in its terminology. It kind of adopts a lot of alchemical terminology, but there's really no historical precedent for it.
Right.
So I reject it as a real form of alchemy. You know, I was in a kind of a big tiff with a guy the other day on the internet about that. But I was like, well, produce the documents. You know, where does this come from?
Right.
And he wanted to tell me about how he was such a great teacher and how he was going to change the world with his insights. And I'm like, hey, you go right ahead there, buddy. but, you know, I think that kind of alchemy leads to
narcissism.
Yeah, well, thanks. You took the word right out of my mouth. Kind of a narcissistic, ego-driven examination of, you know, I read a book and I know something now. And so I think I've discovered a secret. And, you know, you might change a couple of your Facebook icons to some alchemical imagery and think it's kind of cool, you know. But that's not really what I would describe as alchemy. And I think it brings general disrepute on the whole science. So I'm a little bit more than nasty sometimes when I cross paths with these people, because it's really it takes some of the objectivity and it ignores out of it, and it also ignores what the alchemists, the medieval alchemists themselves were talking about, and it tries to spiritualize it.
It isolates it from its historical context.
Exactly. You know? I think when you're doing that,
and it imposes this modern, you know, Jungian interpretation on it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's all just ad hoc, and they beg their own question because they say, well, you know, I know alchemy is just, it's all just a metaphor. Well, because of, you know, what Jung said, or the Jungian interpretation of these terms. So,
mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean,
totally. And here's the thing. I mean, if the alchemists were purposely hiding their ingredients and their methodology, which is really the main things they hide, two things they never talk about. They never talk about the actual substance of what mercury is, and they never talk about their operation, their specific operation. So they're purposely hiding things. And
but they were open. They were open about it being a, and they were consistent and in agreement that it was an external, literal science. Okay,
right. Exactly.
They're actually manipulating, you know, external substances.
Yep.
This isn't just metaphor. Okay.
Well, and they were, and they were hiding that in symbolism.
Right. They were obfuscating, you know, literal, external things with metaphors. Okay. And what these new age people have done today is they've reversed that. See, they're claiming that, see, it was just metaphors. It was all just metaphor, you know. Right. So.
Well, and I also call it a science of secrets, okay? I mean, it's a legitimate science. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But but these people were not purposely revealing what they were doing. They wanted to hide it. There were reasons for that. Whether people agree with that, those reasons or not. But my point is, since they were hiding certain ingredients, you're claiming, if you're like one of these spiritual alchemists, you better have everything right to your, if you're going to make a claim that this is leading to some personal transformation. Because if you get, in alchemy, if you get one ingredient wrong, the whole thing could blow up in your face. Or there's an infinite amount of ingredients. So how do you know you have the right one?
Wasted 6 months or 20 years or
I was just going to say that you've wasted all your time. So how do you know you've hit on the right formula? And, you know, well, personal experience, you know, I've experienced this opening of consciousness and, you know, okay, whatever. But Chris, you had something you wanted to read about Jungian psychological alchemy. And I know you're taking that from that book I recommended. So I'll let you introduce the book and read that. This is a book I highly recommend. You can find it free on the internet, but I recommend you buy a hard copy if you can.
Yeah.
It's really worth buying. But go ahead and introduce the book and go ahead and read that selection.
Okay. Well, this book is called Alchemy Deciphered, and it's by an Alasdair Forsyth, I believe is his name. But anyway, what this author did is pretty unique in terms of kind of all the modern alchemical texts you'd find today. What he did is basically he went through all the quotes of what the actual alchemists said, you know, about their art, and he basically compared them all, and through a statistical mathematical method, basically using, you know, mathematical redundancy and statistical probabilities and such, he basically found that there was a consistent uniform theme amongst basically all the quotations from these alchemists, and it was, they were all in agreement about it being a real, practical, physical science. You know, it wasn't just allegory or metaphor.
Right.
And a lot of the details they were all consistent on as well. You know, and these are all alchemists living in different time periods, you know, separated geographically. Some of them are even competing with each other, you know, but there was still this consistency there.
Let me make two comments about that book, and then you can read that.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things I really like about that book is the bibliography. I mean, almost all those documents in there, if you're really interested in alchemy, those are really good documents. Some are really short. Some are in books. Like, he has Fulcanelli in there.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely has Artifius in there. And I'll make some book recommendations at the end of the podcast. But the other thing I wanted to say about it is that he does a good job, like you said, of kind of condensing the information and showing where their terminology and what they're saying about the process is similar. So that's been really helpful for me, because I needed to solve certain problems, and it was really good to go back and, you know, if you have a certain symbol that you think you have unlocked, then to be able to go back and kind of examine what he's saying, and then put your ingredient in there, then you can kind of make some educated guesses about what the next step is. But the last thing too is he wrote a book that was pretty popular initially. I think this is his better book. The other one is called the Book of Aquarius, and so we're going to talk about that path. And that path is generally an animal alchemy. So we'll talk about different kinds of practical alchemy, but that is what they call the golden water path, which is really a nice way of saying urine. And I'm not saying it's not a legitimate path, but it's kind of a stinky path, so I never went down that. We'll talk about practical alchemy later, but go ahead and read your thing.
Okay, well, so basically he's got this preface in here before he goes into all the quotes from the alchemists and his statistical analysis of them. But he basically wrote this preface to dispel all these modern notions that are just propagated today in popular culture and Facebook and, you know, pretty much all the media outlets, that alchemy is this spiritual, it was all just metaphor, you know, it's this Jungian new age revisionism of, you know, the historical alchemy. And so he wrote this, it's a very short chapter here, just to dispel all that. And I'll just read it here. It says, alchemy as a science or spiritual discipline. Before we begin the statistical analysis, it is required that I address a serious misconception concerning alchemy that exists in popular opinion today to ensure that the reader does not harbor pre-existing bias. This is the perpetuated idea that alchemy is a spiritual discipline. I will address first the European alchemists, from which the vast majority of the sources originate. The spiritual interpretation of alchemy in the West has a relatively short history. Its evolution can be traced and has been called out as fictitious repeatedly by modern historians, though this has made little or no difference to mass popular opinion. The spiritual interpretation of alchemy arose in the 19th and early 20th centuries, along with the theosophical movement and occult revival, and was popularized by Carl Jung, the famous psychiatrist, who is known for his deep interest in the occult. There is no evidence of any spiritual interpretation of alchemy in any texts prior to the 19th century.
Yep.
The spiritual interpretation of alchemy that was made famous by Jung, in fact, reflects religious convictions typical of 19th century occultism and is not supported by the antique and medieval alchemical sources. That was a quote by Kripa Jeffrey John and Glenn W. Shuck from On the Edge of the Future.
You know, I think it's important to point out is that, you know, you have to kind of look at the alchemical literature and the authors that are there, but a lot of these guys were Christian authors. I mean, you know, especially Catholic Christianity was pretty prevalent at that time in Western Europe.
Well, pretty much all the medieval alchemists, when it started out, they all claimed to be.
Yes,
I mean, they
definitely
were all Christian. Yeah,
right. And I think that, you know, if you go back and listen to our other podcast that we did on presuppositionalism, you know, we're kind of making a case that these medieval alchemists, they knew things either through tradition or through
revelation.
Through revelation, but somebody teaching them.
Right.
For instance, Basil Valentine supposedly found documents that revealed the secrets
that were
brought back from the Eastern lands. So, you know, he found something historical that was, you know, just basically laid out for him.
It definitely was not an inductive science.
No, and that was my point, is that it was something kind of deductive, that these premises were assumed true, and then once you knew the proper operations, you could carry these out.
Yes.
And so it, you know, learning or trying to figure it out through inductive means is really,
the alchemist
really,
actually said it was impossible. You actually, there's a quote in here, if we find it later, we can read it, but they would actually say that unless God revealed this to you, or if somebody told you, you cannot figure it out. It's impossible.
Right.
So,
yeah. And I think that there's a little bit of both that goes on because, you know, I know in my own experience, I called them jelly beans the other night. You know, the alchemists have left little jelly beans along the way to point the way to honest seekers.
Yeah.
And you'll see them if you're looking for them. If you read enough and you study enough, and then you can, you know, kind of theorize that there's divine help being given to. I know there's times when I've just opened up and my eyes fell on something, and it just blew me away, like I'd seen it for the first time.
Yeah.
So you could speculate that that was revelatory in a way, that God directed me there or something like that. I'm not claiming that, but I'm just saying that that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Chris. Were you done with your quote? Or?
Oh, no.
Okay,
I'll keep reading it. Okay, so he goes on. He says, the Victorian occult revival was a period of immense interest in all things metaphysical and supernatural. With the discovery of electricity and the uses of magnetism, many things previously considered magic were now called science, and the public was unsure as to where this ended. Alchemy became a popular subject of interest and debate. As often happens when there is a popular question to which there is no absolute answer, various different people publish their own opinions, and over time, the opinions of these individuals became established in popular belief. Quote, some readers may be surprised that the Philosopher's Stone is a physical chemical substance, since many popular treatments of alchemy emphasize the, quote, spiritual dimensions of alchemy, thus distinguishing it strongly from more familiar chemistry. This, quote, spiritual interpretation is, however, predominantly a product of the Victorian occult revival. That was a quote by a Peter Akenstein from Scientific Evidence, Philosophical Theories, and Applications. And so he goes on, he says, the unfortunate consequences of this misconception are perpetuated to this day and represent the contents of virtually every book and article written about alchemy without properly performed academic research or reference to academic research, and even some academic books and papers whose authors did not feel the necessity to do proper research and under which the peer review process failed, most likely due to lack of understanding of the subject matter by both authors and reviewers. Unfortunately, the authors of contemporary alchemical literature appear to have developed a disdain for the scientific method, probably due to the lack of positive interest from the scientific community in the field of alchemy, and this has caused alchemy as a research topic to become stuck in the zeitgeist of the previous century, which happens to be an entirely fictitious misconception supported neither by the authentic sources nor by the research of modern scholars. Okay, so just to comment on that, so back to my whole begging the question thing. So what people are doing today is they'll claim that alchemy was all just metaphor, or it was all just allegory. And their proof for that is a Jungian interpretation of alchemical terms like, you know, spirit or mercury. You know what I mean? So their proof for their claim is the very thing under question. You see, it's just they argue in a circle.
Right.
You see that?
Well, and Fulcanelli says something very similar. He was talking about mesmer and hypnotism, where he was taking a small aspect of the truth and then kind of dividing it up for his own egoistic ends. And this is what he says, you know, because really, I mean, if you were to the average person, if you were to say, what is alchemy? They'd say, oh, isn't that making lead into gold? Because that's what's been popularized in modern culture. Mm-hmm. And so Fulcanelli says this, if alchemy isn't gold making, what is it? Wilmshurst has defined it as the exact science of the regeneration of the human soul from its present sense-immersed state into a perfection and nobility of that divine condition in which it was originally created. Now, Fulcanelli debunks that and says, however,
right,
he immediately goes on to offer a second definition, which clearly implies that, as with gold making, soul making is again only a specific case. By inference, a general theory of alchemy might be ventured. Alchemy is a total science of energy transformation.
Right, right.
That's kind of what we're going to talk about, and that's the tack I take, which is, you know, you're trying to uncover an energy that is available. And it's hidden.
Yes. So just what I was saying is their premises or their support for their conclusion that alchemy is just a metaphor is dependent upon the very assumption that alchemy is a metaphor. Mm-hmm. See, so it's just...
It's circular.
Yeah. So anyway, to continue... So there's a quote here. It says, "Much of the contemporary historical writing on alchemy has unwittingly absorbed themes drawn from 19th century occultism. Anachronistic promoters of so-called spiritual alchemy in that period, such as Mary Ann Atwood and Ethan Allen Hitchcock, avoided the embarrassing fact that many alchemical recipes do not make obvious chemical sense by arguing that such recipes were really not about chemistry at all, but right. veiled prescriptions for perfecting the alchemist's soul." Yeah, see, that's another thing is, and that's one thing that this author does a good job of illustrating in this book, is that all these alchemists, when they were talking about like the operations of alchemy yeah. or the principles, when they weren't like occulting, you know, like what the mercury was or what the actual ingredients are, when they were just talking about like what to do
yeah.
with your hand.
How can you allegorize heated up to, you know, 75
degrees
Celsius?
Yeah, they use very practical, they're like, you know, put this in the crucible, heat it like this, you know, like,
right.
I mean, they're clearly talking about an experimental science, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so. One of the things, you know, I kind of wanted to get across, I don't want you guys to think that, that we're just going to kind of talk about theory all nice, because I think it's okay to reveal some things that, you know, I feel like I've discovered and will help people along in their exploration of this topic. And so there are certain things I won't talk about, and not just because I'm hiding something, but because, you know, I don't think it's always helpful to reveal everything. There's definitely a joy and a I don't want to take away from anybody that's interested in this topic, because there's definitely God, I'm stuck on a word here. Benefits, I guess, to studying this for yourself and drawing your own conclusions and making your own discoveries. Yeah, and in yeah. some ways, it's kind of like an allegory for, you know, the Pilgrim's Progress kind of attitude, or even climbing a mountain. You know, mm-hmm. you can go on a journey with somebody, but unless you have that experience yourself, you don't get the same sense. Or I can tell you about my experience climbing a mountain, but unless you do it yourself, it's not the same, you know?
Right.
And you're not going to have the same difficulty, and you don't get the same fulfillment from it.
You won't have the same appreciation for it either.
Exactly. I do want to
bring up this book, though. It'll actually open it up to it being abused, which is what these alchemists, you know, were worried about.
Right.
You know?
I do want to give a shout-out. I don't recommend people buy this book. I recommend you borrow it or maybe find some excerpts online. It's called A Rosicrucian Notebook. Very occultic in its nature. That's what
very good book.
A very good book, but very occultic in
yeah,
its nature.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, because it covers a lot of different topics. And really the only reason I bought the book was for its few chapters. It has a chapter on the Elixir of Life. It has a
yep.
chapter on the Philosopher's Stone. It has a chapter on transmutation of metals. So
yep.
for those three chapters alone, I was very fascinated. So in one of the chapters, he actually gives specific historical instances. And
of people who achieved it?
Yeah. And
yeah,
Willy
yep.
Schroeder, he was like, you know, one of these guys that, you know, collected all these obscure documents. And what he did is he turned this into a really fantastic book.
Yeah.
Of historical accounts of things like transmutation of lead into gold or silver into gold. You know, so one of the first things that I got out of this book, because, you know, talking about energy transformation and that kind of thing is interesting to me. And, you know, I used to be a high school teacher way back in the day. And what really got me started in alchemy was I got a hold of, I think it was the Book of Artifius or something like that, and I read a whole paragraph, and as a scientist, I'm not used to reading things and then just going, I don't even understand what I just read. And that's what got me fascinated. I was like, how can I read an entire page and not understand a single thing that they're talking about. And, you know, I can't remember the specific page, but it was talking about the mercury and the sulfur and combining that with the salt. And, you know, eventually you get the rebus. And I was like, what? What? You know, so I went on a journey of trying to discover what the heck these medieval alchemists were talking about. But in conjunction with that, I was already very involved in studying alternative science or fringe science. And so there was kind of a crossing of paths with those topics. One of the books that you and I talked about earlier was Joseph Cater's book. It's called The Awesome Life Force. If you can get a hold of that book, that's a great read. Kind of an
extremely difficult read, though.
Yep. But
very technical.
Very technical, but also kind of took a look at energy and the idea of a physical ether that I hadn't seen.
It gives you an idea of what the possible mechanism for alchemy is. Mm-hmm. You know, what is alchemy? What is this substrate that alchemy is actually manipulating?
Okay. Right.
You know, what is the philosopher's stone? Well, this book can give you, you know, some ideas with this whole soft electron, quote unquote, thing.
Yeah.
And
this is a book I can recommend. So I highly recommend people get this. It's an entertaining read, if anything. It's called Invisibility by Steve Richards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, the title alone has you intrigued. But as you go through it, the first few chapters are all about Akasha. And he actually is giving you the physical characteristics of the ether and what he believes electrons are made up of, and how this
luminiferous ether.
Thank you.
Yep.
Operates and what its characteristics are. So I think for that alone, it's really fascinating. But plus, you're getting kind of an Eastern look because he uses a lot of the Eastern terminology of what the first matter is.
Yes, and the whole bent of that book is that he actually contends that all these claims of invisibility throughout history were people manipulating this substance to actually become invisible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? So.
And that's what the book is actually telling you about, is not only the properties of the ether, but how to make a cloud of it so that you can obscure sight, which I thought fascinating. I mean, I'm not trying to make any truth claims about that, but just for that chapter alone, because sometimes I would buy books just for one chapter. And so for me, the whole book has value, but particularly in my alchemical endeavors, that one chapter had a lot of meaning for me. And also, you know, I was reading things like the writings of Wilhelm Reich, Schauberger, Carl von Rickenbach. All these guys were talking about different things, but I came to the conclusion they were really talking about the same thing. So, because they were mentioning terms like orgone or
I was just going to say, you see a consistency among all their writings, you know.
You do, and you start seeing a kind of a similarity of this ether that they're describing, and they're just using different names for it. And it wasn't until I kind of came across the Rosicrucian Notebook that I kind of put it together of what the Philosopher's Stone really is. And because we're making the case that this is a practical science, a lab science, and that the stone is something physical.
Yes.
And really, I think once you kind of open that key up, and this is really something that people will talk about as an open secret. I mean, there are hidden secrets and there are open secrets. And what I mean by an open secret, it's out there, but I don't think a lot of authors are just going to come out and offer that information. But it's available in the writings and the literature that's out there if you look for it. It's not like they obscured that fact.
Right.
It's just they don't talk about a lot, or they just give it a name that we're not familiar with, but they were very familiar with.
Right.
So what is the Philosopher's Stone? That's really one of the things that I wanted to make sure came across this podcast, is I've heard a lot of interpretations of what it is, especially if you go on these alchemy forums. They'll say it's the soul, or, you know, it's your auric field or something like that. Mm-hmm. But what I've come to see it as is a maximum amount of life force in a minimum amount of space.
Right.
And there
are concentrated in a substance.
Yeah, I believe it's a solid form of the ether.
That you can actually ingest.
And if you ingest too much, it increases the internal heat too much, and you can hurt yourself. So there are limits to it. But really, I actually met a guy the other day, Chris, that talked about it as being undifferentiated matter. And that's
term true.
That you and I were using, where it's an etheric form. It doesn't really have a...
It's the prima materia, the base matter.
Exactly. It hasn't differentiated itself into a metal or an element yet. So you're getting it in its raw state.
And again, that's what you see in like Cater's book. By the soft electron, he's theorizing about this basically like this subtle particle, but it can also act as a wave.
Right.
But it precedes the electron.
Well, that's what I like about Cater's work, is he kind of solves that problem of the wave particle theory of light, because he sees it as kind of the ability of the ether to grow very large, and that's what a soft electron is, whereas a hard electron is actually a much smaller, more condensed form
right.
of the ether.
Right.
And
exactly.
So hard electrons you can detect. Soft electrons are a lot harder to detect, but he says that's what we're living off of. So it's a form of the ether that is basically, usable for the human body or for any living body, for that matter.
Yeah.
I think that that has been revealed in several books, so I don't question that. I think it's the egoists out there in the internet land that want to think that they've discovered something that will call it something else. Now, if you're involved with inner alchemy, I think the Philosopher's Stone is definitely of that same substance. It just is not as solid, because you're circulating energy and you're trying to vortex it inside your body and that kind of thing, it's not going to ever become as condensed in a sense, if you're doing it that way. Mm-hmm. But the alchemists warn you. They warn you that there are dangers. There's dangers to arriving at this. There's dangers of people that want to take this information from you. There's dangers of explosions. I mean, there are people that do it wrong and they get the wrong ingredients. I've heard of people using phosphorus and blowing up their lab or burning themselves. I have a few scars. It's not without, mostly it's because I don't realize something's hot and I pick it up. So that's the main danger of alchemy I've come across, is don't assume anything is not hot. Use tongs. If you're going to become a practical alchemist, that's the best advice I can give you. Buy a good pair of tongs and use tongs, even if you know it's not hot. But there are a lot of names for the Philosopher's Stone, just to give you a few. The Red Lion, Hermetic Gold, the Golden Fleece, Rebus. The Rebus means a two thing, so there's kind of a hint there. The Azoth. The Azoth is a really interesting word. Lapis Philosophorum, which is really just a Latin word for Philosopher's Stone. Arum Potable. And I think this is a term that confuses a lot of people, because that means drinkable gold.
Potable gold,
gold, basically.
Right.
And so that has led a lot of practitioners, even myself, to go down the path of really experimenting on gold. Gold is, I think, definitely involved, but I don't think you start there. Gold, I think, is something that it's another symbol.
It's another blind, yeah.
Yeah. And so they'll talk about their gold. They'll talk about their mercury. So really the three substances you're going to hear repeated over and over again in alchemical literature is the mercury, the sulfur. Sometimes they'll mention the salt. usually, though, before there's an alchemist by the name of Geber. Before Geber's time, they don't really mention the salt. After Geber, they include this salt. So my conclusion is that the salt is not a third ingredient necessarily, but it's a resultant product of the mercury and sulfur. And, you know, I could be wrong about that, but that's just my conclusion of why you see it mentioned previously and now you don't. Other way around, I'm sorry. You didn't see it mentioned, now you see it mentioned. There's definitely other names that are confusing. For instance, they'll talk about the philosophical mercury and or the philosophical stone, which is they distinguish between that and the philosopher's stone. And these are all, like I said, they're all symbolic blinds. You got to figure out what they're talking about. You know, they'll tell you what they mean. For instance, with the philosophical stone, they'll say that it's a young philosopher's stone, and that all it needs is the proper development. You know,
it needs to germinate.
It needs to germinate. They won't tell you how to do that. They'll say
or how long it takes.
Right. And there's definitely two paths that practical alchemists follow. Well, let me go back a step, because there's different types of practical alchemy. So there were some practical alchemists that would get into this, and they would really quickly have that desire to transmute metals, you know, for riches and that kind of thing. And so there became a whole medieval science called alchemy that was concerned with the transmutation of metals. And these eventually became called particulars. And there are a whole bunch of recipes. Another book I can highly recommend is called The Rams Digital Library. And that has thousands of alchemical documents. It's almost something that's too overwhelming because it has so many different documents. But a lot of those processes in there are recipes, are alchemy recipes for trying to create something you would never want to ingest. It's not the true stone. It's some metallic stone that may be useful. There were some stones that could transmute one metal into another, but not anything else. For instance, it could take, you know, copper and turn it into tin or something. But it wasn't useful for anything else. Right. And it was really the alchemists, I think, that gave rise to more of these chemical discoveries and tried to kind of standardize their science. And so they would run across things that were unusual but also useful. For instance, the invention of creosote was discovered that way. And, you know, because they were, you know, the person saw this black color and they were like, hey, I've done it. I've done the first step of alchemy to find out, you know. It made a very good preservative for wood, but that was about it. So there are a lot of dead ends and blind alleys that people went down. You really see the development of our periodic table. You know, there were all sorts of periodic tables and all sorts of schemes to try and standardize what they were observing. That's a fascinating subject in itself. I haven't really done a lot of research into it, but I've seen them, and it's really interesting to see, you know, the different incarnations, because there wasn't great communication back there either. So, you know, somebody had one scheme, another guy had another scheme, but these guys weren't collaborating. So, you know, there was no consistency. Mm-hmm. Another one of the practical alchemy arts that you'll run across a lot is called spagyrics. And this mainly involves plant science. Right. And even the spagyrists will admit that you cannot make the philosopher's stone from plants. My belief is that ether is just not condensed enough, or it's not prevalent enough in plants to achieve that end. But you can make useful medicines and useful stones. It's kind of, I don't know, kind of sexy, I guess, because people get involved with the distillation lab ware and, you know, they kind of look like a chemist and they look like an alchemist. And I think people really get into that. I'm not knocking it at all. I think some people have, it's a legitimate part of alchemy, and it's not something it's something I know a little bit about, but I never really was that interested in to buy the distillation setup. And because I was like, well, if the ultimate goal is philosopher's stone and you can't arrive at that, then why am I going down that road, you know?
Right. Right.
So I think that their interpretation of some of these hidden elements too, like mercury and sulfur, there's kind of a question mark there where whether they're really talking about the same thing. And you'll run across that a lot. When people will use that terminology, but they'll never really define it. What do you mean by the mercury? And alchemists tend to be a little secretive. Even the guys that are in a spagyric alchemy, so they won't always say what their beginning substance is. So that creates confusion too. Then you'll have alchemists also say a certain chemical, like the spirit of tartar or sodium hydroxide or something like that, and but that will also be a metaphor. So they'll actually name substances that have nothing to do with the alchemical work, and yet they used it. For instance, vitriol. Vitriol is definitely I've come to know it as an acronym for, loosely translated, it's something like the substance that is drawn out of the earth or something like that.
Right.
I'd have to go back and look it up. But it's a long series of Latin words that basically mean that. And so, but vitriol is also a chemical substance. And so people would confuse that with some of these medieval substances and not understand that the real alchemists, when they were talking about mercury, I still meet alchemists that try to use common mercury, you know, the metal.
Yeah.
I think that's the, you know, that's the secret. And they're like, oh, well, it's a double blind. They're trying to deceive you into thinking that it's not mercury, but it really is mercury, you know. And I'm like, no. Somebody like Fulcanelli, he'll just come right out and say, no.
Mercury. A lot of the alchemists would just straight up say that, this is not. This is an actual mercury.
So, and the last one is an animal mercury, and that's kind of what I have alluded to before when I was talking about the Book of Aquarius. You know, he was that was a pretty popular book in alchemical circles. I was on several websites. People were attempting to distill down their urine and ferment it and do all these different things with it. I know that sounds gross, but I can understand why they were doing that, because this there is a central belief that there is a salt in everything that is kind of undefined, and we could almost, you know, kind of conclude that it's already condensed into a solid. The ether is already condensed into a solid in living substances, and so they're trying to draw it out of animal products, you know, any fluids or anything like that. And urine is the most readily available. And I've really never seen anybody succeed to it with it. And I think one of the reasons that they don't is they have two misconceptions. One is they think that they have to dissolve gold, which I used to think too, and that is somehow and I'll tell you what happens when you dissolve gold. If you can dissolve gold without acids, it will dissolve into a red oil, which I believe is the elixir. Okay.
Yes.
It's a very weak elixir, and the problem becomes, because you never discovered what the mercury was, you can't really enhance that.
Can't develop it further.
You can't develop it. So you now have a stagnant substance. So that's two reasons that I never went down that path. I determined that urine alchemy is kind of a dead end, because yes, you can dissolve gold if you do it right, and there's another path called the dew path, which I can talk about too. But the urine path never really defines what the mercury is. It's trying to find this salt and then use that to dissolve gold without acids. Again, you can dissolve gold, but gold is really hard to dissolve. So that's what aqua regia is. Aqua regia is a combination of two acids, sulfuric acid and hydrochloric acid, I think. And so you use those two acids. This is what they do in gold reclamation. They'll dissolve gold, and then they'll distill off, or they'll burn off the acid, and then you get the gold behind. So if you have like a computer component, you can dissolve the plastics and all that, and then you can separate that from the gold components. But acid is expensive, and you know, it's also you're not reducing the gold, you're not re-incruding the gold. That's a term that alchemists will use, re-incruding, which means to make it go back into its first state.
Right.
And so, you know, what do they mean by that? Well, alchemists had a belief that all metals grow. They start from this prima materia.
Right.
And through different processes.
They germinate in the earth.
Right. They germinate in the earth and they grow. And their final goal is
become gold.
Is to become gold. And if they if these substances are interrupted anywhere along the way, then they become the baser metals. Like,
so basically alchemy was artificially mimicking the process that occurs in nature.
Well, and the alchemists will talk about that. They'll say the processes that happen in the earth take thousands of years.
Yes, and it's accelerated because they would say that this occurs over extremely slowly in nature. Yep. So
they're imitating nature, but also speeding it up.
Yeah.
And so that's why they are always talking about examining nature. You know, they use
nature
as a different
teacher. Yeah.
Right. And it really is. I mean, I've come to learn that myself. One of the things that always confused me is they always talked about, you know, feeding your stone and then removing the excrement. And I never really understood what they meant by that. And so I have some better ideas now about what I think they mean. Because they talk about it growing like a chick embryo. A chick embryo is a great metaphor. They also call it the philosophical egg, the whole work.
Yeah.
Because you have the yolk, and you have the white, and you have the shell.
Yep.
And so one of the primary maxims is one matter, one fire, one vessel.
Right.
And the egg kind of summarizes that. And I really like symbols that are very poignant or simple, because I think they almost communicate more to me. I think when you get more complex symbols, I should go back and say my belief is that I don't think the true alchemy is that complicated. I think that they've made it complicated to obscure it.
Yes.
And they've given so many symbols to it that it's hard to make sense of what they're really talking about, because it looks like they're being contradictory. And that's what I like about the Alchemy Deciphered book that you read from, is that he is showing that they're not talking about different things. They're talking about the same thing.
Yep.
So, I mean, animal alchemy, I never really have gone down that path, but that is the golden water path is what they call it. You know, I like I said, I think it's a legitimate path. And there's another book I have here. It's kind of a funny book. I don't have it in front of me. I'll have to look it up later. I don't remember that. It's the Hidden Book of Rubinstein or something like that. I always have to look at the guy's name because it's like some East Austrian name, you know. Mm-hmm. But it has a lot of particulars in there. And what's really funny about the book is, like, every other word is a symbol. So you have to go to the index and look up the symbol. Like, what's the symbol for iron? You know, and then you go look it up, and then you come back and you read another section. And it says, you know, place the iron in the crucible and then put another symbol, you know, and you got to go to the index and look at the symbol and go back and forth. So it's almost like a coded work. But luckily they put another work at the back of the book to kind of decode the code, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you're very familiar with alchemical symbols or you have that index, then it's really a hard book to read. I believe it's in the Rams Digital Library, though, too. I think if you buy that, you can probably get that book. But what I learned from that is that one of the things that he states is that there are as many ways to create the Philosopher's Stone as there are days in the year. And I really believe that. I didn't used to believe that. I used to believe there was one true way. But I think if you know what they are talking about, there are different particulars that will arrive – had it, and I don't think that's what he's talking about. I think he's talking about that all these different substances involve the same substance. This, you know,
yeah,
this internal fire.
It's the same process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I did want to mention is the dew path, and you have the same problem as the urine path, because one of the things you run into is, okay, what is the mercury? Okay, so when I did the dew path, and I still am a little mystified on how I did it, but I think I know how I did it. Is what you do with the dew path is you go out during the summer months, and in very early morning hours, you collect dew. And there's different ways you can do that. Some of the ways that I did it is I would take glasses of water that had, no, not glasses of water, but glasses of ice. And then water would condense, the morning dew would condense on the outside. And then I had all these different glasses in different glass pans. And then that dew would collect and condense on the cold glass and drip down into the pan. It was kind of a laborious process. You know, it took me, you know, several weeks of getting up at 3, 4 a.m. and going out and collecting this dew. And not every morning are you going to get dew. If it rains, you're, you know, out of luck. And it's better, supposedly, during a full moon. So, because that energy that you're trying to collect is supposed to be more prevalent. So anyways, I collected all this dew, and then I believed at the time that, you know, it was important to have a carrying agent, so I added this carrying agent. And I let that ferment for like a year, because I didn't really know what to do with it. I was kind of reading a lot at that point, and I was like, I didn't want to waste it, because it took me a long time to collect. Yeah. But I think through that process of letting it sit in a dark cabinet for a year, uh-huh, I think it naturally fermented. And I think it condensed that salt that's in the air that these alchemists were trying to collect. Because there is a book called the Mutus Liber that people take this process from. It's called the Silent Book. And so it has is pictures, and it has pictures of these people laying out sheets in the morning and then bringing in the sheets and wringing out the dew that they collect from the grass. And then they show them boiling this dew. By the way, that's one of the interpretations of what Rosicrucian means. Brotherhood of the Boiling Dew. It's one of the interpretations. It's also one of the names of the Philosopher's Stone, or that prima materia, which is called dew, or celestial dew.
Yep.
So this is where we get into symbolism, because I'm a little bit more on a roll now, you know, and I'm just, all these symbols are kind of bouncing through my head. But so anyways, you take that. Well, I took that, and I think incorrectly I was actually heating this in a crucible I made out on the backyard, and I was using a fire, you know, just a natural fire to heat this stuff up. And, you know, I would let it heat for 7 hours at a time, and I did this, you know, 7 or 8 times. And eventually I got a salt out of that I decided to mix it with gold. I can't even tell you why I thought to do that. I mixed it with some gold leaf I had, and I put it back out in the fire, because I thought, fire, I thought it had to be fed with fire or something, and you know, mm-hmm, to be honest with you, I didn't know as much as I knew now, so I was kind of doing things out of ignorance. I was just kind of doing best guess kind of stuff and things I'd read. Well, I went out on my workbench, and I saw this, like, red oil. It almost looked like blood. I thought I had cut myself, actually. That's how deep a red it was. And I saw a couple drops of this, and I was like, so I started looking at my hands. Did I cut myself? What, you know, what happened? And I tasted it, you know, and it tasted like honey. And all these images of things I'd read came back to me. I'm going, oh my gosh, you know, that is the gold dissolved, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I had some problems, you know, I didn't, you know, so.
You didn't know how you did it.
I didn't know how I did it. And I didn't know I didn't know what the mercury was and the sulfur and, you know, so I didn't know things about it. I just kind of had this happy accident.
Yeah.
And, but it also led me to believe that, hey, this is a real substance. I'm not. It gave me confidence I was going down at least some correct paths. Now, I think the dew path has the same problems that any other path has, which is, you can't develop it. Now, when I opened up my crucible in the morning, I was definitely wrong about, you know, heat being a magical ingredient to advancing that and turning it into a stone. Basically, it was all evaporated away, so that was pretty disappointing, because I would have had quite a bit of that stuff to play around with and experiment on. So anyways, it was an experiment. I learned something from it, and but it shows you that there are other paths. I just, you know, can you arrive at the Philosopher's Stone through that path? I don't think so. Yeah. But I don't know, because I don't know everything. So, so anyways, Chris, there was that passage from Fulcanelli you were going to.
Hold on. Let me pull that up.
While you're doing that, I'm going to look for something here too. I pulled up. Okay, so this is what Fulcanelli had to say in The Dwellings of the Philosophers. And I'm reading this more so you can get a sense of how he mixes in, you know, the reality of the Philosopher's Stone and the elixir with symbolism. And so when I'm at the end of the selection, you're going to probably have more questions than you came away with, which is kind of why I like alchemy. But so we know that it must be vanquished by the sulfur, issuing from its own substance, which it has itself generated, so as to obtain, after its death, this partly fixed, partly volatile, philosophical mercury, which the subsequent maturation will raise to the degree of perfection of the elixir. All the authors teach the living must be killed if the dead is to be resurrected. And this is why you have a lot of grave terminology and crow symbolism and that kind of stuff.
The dead head. The skull. Yeah. Yep.
This is why the good artist will not hesitate to sacrifice the bird of Hermes. Again, that kind of gives you the idea of a phoenix, you know, dying and being resurrected. Yep. To sacrifice the bird of Hermes and to initiate the mutation of its mercurial properties into sulfurous qualities, since any transformation remains subject to a preliminary decomposition and cannot be completed without it. Basil Valentine states that the twofold fiery man must be fed a fiery swan. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me reread that. The twofold fiery man must be fed a snowy swan. And he adds, then the swan roasted will become food for the king. Mm. A statement like that just blows me away, because, you know, what do they mean by the twofold fiery man? What do they mean by the snowy swan? What do they mean by roasting it? Is that literally a fire, or is that a allegory for a fire? Mm. And the food for the king, I think, is, you know, basically...
Well, that sounds like when they would redistill it and sublimate it and multiply it, and that's what it sounds like to me when they would... Because they... Wouldn't they... That's what this guy talks about, is wouldn't they like redistill it in order to make it stronger?
Right.
And such.
Right. It brings us to really, you know, back to practical alchemy, and not these other sciences we were talking about, the spagyrics or animal alchemy. But true alchemy, I think what you're trying to do is you're trying to discover what is the mercury, what is the sulfur, and what do they mean by these processes? That's what it kind of boils down to.
Uh-huh.
Because there are two different paths within this true alchemy too. There's a wet path and a dry path. So what you're talking about is this idea of sublimation, which is in the alchemical mind different than what a chemist would mean by sublimation.
Right.
So what they mean by sublimation is allowing it to kind of rise up in these alchemics.
Yep.
Alembics, I'm sorry.
Alembics,
And then recirculate back down.
Right.
And so by sublimation, they're really talking about kind of evaporation and then the recirculation of these things.
Yeah.
And that's not really what chemical sublimation is. So the same thing's true with calcination. You know, in chemistry, you know, if you calcinate something, you're burning it to an ash. Mm-hmm. In alchemical calcination, you're not doing that. It's an allegory, or it's a... I don't think allegory is even a good word. It's more like a hint of what the process is.
Yeah.
But alchemical calcination is not the same. And George Ripley has like these 12 gates, I think it is. That's another book I can recommend. In Pursuit of Gold Alchemy in Theory and Practice. And I've gotten a lot out of this book. I mean, it's, you'll read a lot of it and go, I don't know what he's talking about. But you need to read and reread these things. And one of the things that they talk about are these 12 gates. And so if you go to YouTube and type in alchemy, they'll run through these things and what they think they mean. So they'll talk about calcination, solution, separation, conjunction, putrefaction, congelation, cibation, sublimation, fermentation, exaltation, multiplication, yep, and projection. And that sounds like it's a very complicated process.
Well,
it's
in this book, the alchemist would say that it's actually just one process. Those are all just one operation. Those are all just different stages of this one process that occurs naturally.
Yep. And Fulcanelli would second that. He would say there's three operations, but they're really the same operation.
Right. Right.
But with slightly different endpoints. And so that's confusing. And they'll, to even confuse it more, Fulcanelli will say, well, within those three operations are seven other operations.
Right.
He calls the seven eagles. So, you know, this is it's a maze of confusion is what it is that the alchemists have created for you. And but go ahead and read that quote, because I think it's very indicative of what is required of you if you're going to really get into this.
Yeah, hold on.
Oh, you're still looking for it?
It says, right here, I got it.
Okay, go ahead.
The mysterious science requires great precision, accuracy, and perspicacity in observing the facts. A healthy, logical, and reflective mind, a lively but not overexcitable imagination, a warm and pure heart. It also demands the greatest simplicity and complete indifference with regard to theories, systems, and hypotheses, which are generally accepted without question on the testimony of books or the reputation of their authors. It requires its candidates to learn to think more with their own brains and less with those of others. Finally, it insists that they should check the truth of its principles, the knowledge of its doctrine, and the practice of its operations from nature, the mother of us all.
Cool. I you know, that's from Fulcanelli, right?
Yeah. Yep.
I think that is the best way to say it. I don't think I could say it. You know, all those attributes, especially the subtlety of mind and being creative but not overly imaginary, is very important, because it's easy to get bogged down in fanciful theories. It's even easy to get bogged down with your own ego in thinking you've stumbled upon something correctly and not re-examining your theories later on. You know, for instance, one of the theories I had was that the dew path was the correct path, and that this mercury could be found, you know, in the air, and all you needed to really do was collect it, you know, and heat it up. So that was a theory I had. It wasn't necessarily a wrong theory, but it led me down other paths. So that's why I said at the beginning, you know, if you're going to get into alchemy, especially practical alchemy, expect a lot of failure, but it's the journey that's fun. And it's not necessarily going to lead to the production of Philosopher's Stone. But, you know, you never know. So it's definitely a journey, though, and be prepared for that. And don't think that you're going to read two books and discover the secrets of alchemy. I don't think that's going to happen. Hey, we do have a couple other people on the call. They've been very patient and quiet, letting Chris and I kind of talk about some of these things. So Ross and Jorge, do you guys have any questions at this point? I mean, did you guys write some things down? You were like, what are these guys even talking about? I mean,
well, I just, this is Ross. I wrote down all those books you mentioned, read through them later. I did have a few questions about some of the stuff you've been mentioning elsewhere.
Okay.
You mentioned taking, you know, high quality sea salt to improve your stomach acid for better digestion.
Are you, you're talking about in the group?
Yeah.
I think Dave, yeah, that was Dave Callham.
Oh, that was, okay.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that either, you know.
Well, salt actually is what produces hydrochloric acid.
Right.
That's what he was talking about for that.
You know, I did have one thing I was kind of, I found interesting was that, you know, you mentioned there was more than one way to make the zone. I mean, it's not just a one way, you know. There's multiple ways. I found that pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think in theory that's true. I think there are easier ways and more productive ways to go down, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, of course. They're not all going to be equal.
Exactly. No. So, you know, let's say you had success with the urine path. If you didn't know what the mercury was, like I said before, you're going to be stuck. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fulcanelli mentions that. He says, with exact knowledge of chemistry, you can do this a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
But you would have to know what these substances are that they're talking about, at least at their base principle, you know. Because I don't think mercury is necessarily an individual substance. It's not like, oh, is he talking about sodium chloride? Oh, that's the mercury. You know, I don't think they're talking about that. I think they're talking about something that was kind of undefinable for them.
Yeah.
And they were drawing it out of certain substances, and then they would give it a name.
Right.
You know, so there are definitely processes that you can experiment around with, and, you know, that's why you have to come up with good theories. And, you know, any alchemist I've ever talked to that is actually a working practical alchemist, they talk about, you know, you got to develop theories and get out in your lab and work, because you've, a lot of it's through observation. So, but really the symbolism has helped me a lot. And I don't think we've really mentioned that many, like the griffin is the eagle and the lion. They talk about the fox and the rooster a lot.
The dragon.
Yep. There's a lot of dragon metaphors. That, you know, there's, I have a lot of affinity for the whole Lord of the Rings thing too, because
the red king and the white queen.
Yep. But not only that, what I really like is that image of at Khazad Dûm when Gandalf is fighting the Balrog.
Yeah.
That is the most alchemical image of anybody could create.
Doesn't he say I am the keeper of the secret fire?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's straight up.
So that tells me right there that, because I think that phrase is used in the book, that he's a keeper of the secret fire. Or a servant.
Yeah.
He says, I'm a servant of the secret fire.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what they call this ether. They call it the secret fire. Okay.
Right.
The
reasoning was, in order to heat something up, it requires an external fire, right? So what is the fire that heats the fire?
Right.
They would say, well, it's this secret fire. There's a fire behind fire itself. You know, it's more subtle.
And fire is always associated with life, and cold is always associated with death.
Yeah.
And so the alchemists believed that everything had, like, this internal fire if it was living.
Right. Yeah.
And to the degree that you had this internal fire, you know, or could maintain that internal fire, defined how long you were going to live.
Mm-hmm.
Once you expelled that. I was going to tell a story, but I'm not going to. Anyways, the Lord of the Rings symbolism there with Gandalf. Okay, first of all, the color gray, you know, he's got his gray robe. It's a very important color. It also kind of crosses over with violet. Sometimes they'll use colors like that to describe the properties of the substances involved. And sometimes they'll use the color as a kind of a more historical information, like the color black is usually associated with death. White is usually associated with purity and death, sometimes too. And red is usually associated with the sun or with
gold.
Can be with gold. Fire. Red is also associated with the ethers and with fire.
Yeah. Well, it's the color of the stone.
Yep, it definitely is the color of the stone, and that's something that they don't equivocate on within the, you know, like in the book Alchemy Deciphered.
Yeah, they're all consistent.
They're very consistent.
It's a red.
What it looks
red
like.
Substance.
Yeah. It's a red some substance. Some of them will actually. You know,
some of them will actually come straight out and say it's a red powder.
Yep.
Which I think it is.
You know, sometimes it's a red wax because they call it fusible, like wax, so it's easily kind of pinched together.
Isn't it impervious to fire as well?
Yes.
It cannot be heated or...
Well, it can be dissolved. They describe it as being dissolved. I think heating it actually enhances the quality of it, according to what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I think a quicker way to multiply it and to... improve the quality is to both heat it and add this mystical mercury to it. At least that's what alchemy.
Right, and then they would redistill that and sublimate it and keep doing that over and over again, and it would multiply it.
Yeah, in both quality and
it would also make it stronger.
So what you're seeing with that picture of Gandalf fighting the Balrog. It's the same picture that Cyrano de Bergerac uses of the salamander and remora, these creatures of fire and ice that fight each other. And so you have Gandalf really kind of representing the remora. He has the gray color, which is also described as the remora. I'll talk more about the remora in a second. But he has a oak staff, at least it looks like oak, which oak is a very prominent symbol in alchemical literature. You'll see it repeated over and over again with some of the Greek symbols that they use. I think there's a secret there with the actual name oak. I tried to find out, I did a lot of research on that name oak, and I used to have this old dictionary. There's an old French dialect called Argo. And I used to have an old Argo dictionary I found online. And I actually found the word oak in there. It didn't mean oak. And, you know, so I don't know if the French/Western alchemists were using that term to describe that substance. But it was an interesting correlation there. Fulcanelli goes through that word too. Really, if you buy Mystery of the Cathedrals, what the premise of Mystery of the Cathedrals is his idea is that the alchemists built certain buildings, like the cathedral at Notre Dame.
Notre Dame, yeah. Yep.
And what he does then is he goes through the different areas of the church there.
They encoded alchemical symbolism into the actual architecture.
Exactly. And he goes about decoding that symbolism through the entire book. And then he kind of goes off on these tangents about different symbols and stories of, Hercules or Jason and the Golden Fleece, you know, the Argonauts, Ophirus. Ophirus is another symbol I took a lot away from. He becomes Saint Christopher later on. And Christopher means Christ carrier, which, again, there's a lot of Christian metaphors. And this is where, like, again, the spiritual alchemists are taking this stuff, and they're reinterpreting it into the Christ consciousness or whatever. And what these Christians were doing, though, is they were saying, hey, we know about this substance that's all around us, and they're using Christ as a metaphor for it. And
Well, it's funny, because you actually see that symbolism in the Bible, too. Christ is likened to a stone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is Yahweh. He's the chief cornerstone.
Yeah.
The builders rejected, you know. The alchemists talk about crucifixion a lot. Crucifixion usually has to do with...
death state.
It can have to do with death, but it more has to do with fire. And they were using the name, I think, more as a... like crux or cruce means fire. But it had more to do with the application of fire. That's where we get crucible from, too. I mean, these roots all have similarities. So, you know, one of the symbols, you know, they have the three iron nails that were used to crucify Christ. So that whole metaphor, even the water pouring out of his side, you know, alchemists have used that to describe their work. I think iron there is important. You see that repeated over and over again, this idea of the ram. Okay, we'll go back to Lord of the Rings for a second. Now, at least in the movie version, you have competing symbols there, because in the movie version you have the Balrog with a ram's head, and then in the book version he has a lion's head, a fiery lion, and both of those could be indicative of the same substance there. But really, what the salamander represents, it's a creature of fire, and so this Balrog is a creature of fire. You know, he's got a fiery sword.
What is that? Is that the sulfur then?
That's the sulfur, and that's so. What you're seeing is this marriage, and the marriage metaphor is very prevalent too. So you have the marriage always of the mercury and the sulfur. Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so Gandalf kind of represents that mercurial substance, and he has the gray cloak. He also has a oak staff with a light in it, and that, you know, that crystal up there. So he has the internal light. Quote unquote. That's my interpretation. And he has, you know, his sword. And now, a lot of times, the mercury is described as their steel. Okay. And you'll see that idea of a sword or a spear with Saint George,
the sword and the
dragon,
the sword and the stone.
I was just going to say that one too. The sword and the stone. We'll go back to that one in a second. I think there's a lot of information there with the sword and the stone. I really like the symbolism. I hope you guys can tell that, because that has helped me more than anything. But I think it helped me develop theories about what they were talking about, because Fulcanelli spends a lot of time kind of toying with you, going through the language. What does salamander mean? You know, he'll go through the idea that salamander has to do with salt, and mander meaning, what does it mean again? I think he's talking about the salt of the stable, I think is what he to mean. And
I don't want to get like too off topic here, but you could also you could also kind of pull out of this symbolism being so prevalent in like media and pop culture and everything, is that there's people that definitely know about this, you know?
Right. And so, if they don't know, they're accurately repeating the symbols. Yeah. I think that the fact that they replaced that with a ram's head, to me, is very telling that they do know. Or at least somebody was pointing at that and saying, no, you need to change that into a ram's head. And I'm not going to tell you why, but that's what you're going to do. You know, because why would they change it, you know?
Right.
You could make a fearsome-looking lion.
Right.
So these are just theories, but they're fun to toy around with. But the steel is a repeated metaphor. You see it with George and the dragon, where he's killing the dragon with a spear. Cadmus killing Python. What he does is he pins Python against a tree. I believe it's an oak tree. you know, with a spear, an iron spear. So that idea of steel and iron.
You could also see that the tree element with Christ, he was originally hung on a tree.
Yeah, definitely.
And the spear, too. He was pierced with the spear.
Pierced with a spear. The water coming out, that's kind of repeated also in the story of St. Christopher when he's trying to carry passengers over the raging waters. You see a Hippocrene, I believe, is the horse that kicks the rock, and then out comes a flood. They also talk about Aaron striking the rock with his rod, and then having the flood come out. So a lot of it has to do with striking. And that's where we go back to sword and the stone. There's a steel there opening up the stone. That's the way I see it, at least. It's not a steel that's in the stone, but it's, you know, what is Arthur do with Excalibur? He draws it out.
Right.
So I've taken that as a kind of a metaphor for drawing something out of the earth. The earth is kind of a metaphor for, you know, a substance that you want to draw this salt out of.
I see.
Draw this substance out of.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You kind of see it, too, with the whole idea of Smaug being in the mountain.
I was going to say, yeah, he's the dragon, and he guards the he guards the Arkenstone.
Right.
It's pretty obvious that that's the Philosopher's Stone.
Well, yeah, you know, I even looked up that. The Arkenstone has to do with the Holy Stone.
Yeah.
And he's protecting the Holy Stone deep in the bowels of the earth, you know.
Right. Uh-huh.
You also see the colors of alchemy there, and we didn't really cover that, but the three prominent colors are black, white, and red.
Right.
And they have analogous
associations with certain stages of the work.
Well, not only that, but they have associations with substances like the earth is black, water is considered white, air is yellow, and the ether is red.
Fire, yeah.
You have the crow being symbolic of black, the swan associated with white, and the pheasant associated with fire or the ether.
Hmm.
Also the phoenix.
Phoenix, yeah. Yeah.
Gray kind of signifies a damp fire. You know, it's color of mercury.
Hmm.
'Cause they'll talk about it's a fire, or it's a... what do they say? They'll talk about it being a wet fire, a damp fire, and a dry fire. That always kind of confused me. But if you know what they're talking about with mercury, you'll understand what they mean. Because they're not talking about literal fire. See, they're talking about this internal fire, this fire of the ether.
Right.
And so when they're talking about a wet fire, if you're doing it the wet way, well, that makes total sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's their mercury is something wet. They talk about a water that does not wet the hands. That's what I'm talking about. That's a confusing little riddle right there. I'm not going to break that knot for anybody because, you know, it's just a theory for me. But I don't want to steer somebody down a path if I'm wrong.
Right.
But I have a theory about why they say it's a water that doesn't wet the hands.
Let's go back to the Gandalf and the Balrog. So why does he become Gandalf the White then?
Well, exactly. So you're seeing that same transformation there because they do a battle, just like the Salamander and the Remora do. They battle, and coincidentally, they battle deep in the bowels of the earth, you know. And
uh-huh.
then he's resurrected, okay? He dies, and he's resurrected as Gandalf the White. And so at least you have two of the alchemical colors there. You kind of have the black of the darkness, and then you have this resurrection of Gandalf the White.
That's the first two stages there.
Right, and that's really the most important part of the work. I mean, most of the alchemists will talk about the philosophic stone as being white.
Yeah, they say the white stone is the stone. The red stone is just a further development of the white stone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
when you have the white stone, when you have the stone, you just have to develop it further.
Different names they've given this mercury to, you know, increase the... confusion, I think, but I think they're worth mentioning. They talk about virgin's milk, dew of May, magnesia. Magnesia is a really interesting word because it means literally a flesh magnet.
Mm-hmm.
That's what magnesia means. And I don't think it means flesh like human flesh or anything like that. I think it has to do with more taking something that was previously not solid and making it solid, like fleshing it out.
Yeah.
And so it's a magnet that draws something in, you know?
Uh-huh.
The fountain, again, we have that idea of, you know, the waters bursting forth. Their steel, the herb of Saturn, green lion. Green lion's a really interesting one. That's one of my favorite images, actually. Is that green lion biting the sun?
Oh, yeah.
You see that?
Yeah, eating
blood?
The sun. Yeah.
Yeah.
The blood coming out, yeah.
Yep, that's a great symbol. Green vitriol. There's that word again, vitriol.
Would the green represent the earth again? And then biting
usually,
the...
Well, usually The alchemists talk about it representing something young, something that's undeveloped, but alive.
Oh, okay.
You know, so green usually has to do with a youthful state, something that's not seen its full fruition yet. But there's analogous stories too. Like, you know, the question comes up then: did some of these symbols, like Arthur and the Holy Grail, was that made? Did the alchemists make that story to describe their, you know, their process, or was that story kind of there and they just kind of adopted it? You know,
right, right.
Because you seem a very similar story in Tristan and Isolde. You know, you see the betrayal of the king, a marriage between the lover and the woman. They do it in a garden. There, you know, some of the images you'll see fruits developed in this mystical garden, which usually represent like the Hesperides and the fruit, the tree of life fruit. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a very similar story to the whole story of King Arthur. Man, I didn't really pull out this quote, but the Holy Grail, the, you know, taking down the words, you know, there was a popularity of that book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the interpretation of what they said the Grail meant, you know, it had to do with the bloodline. And there was a different interpretation I read, and I don't have it anymore. I have to look it up. And but man, it was great because it described the Philosopher's Stone to a T. So the Holy Grail really being the Philosopher's Stone, not being this bloodline of Christ or something, you know. So it was pretty cool. But I know which book it's in. I just have to recreate. You know, I don't always bookmark everything. So did you guys have any other questions, Ross or Jorgie?
Yeah.
Well, shoot them out, man.
Let's see. I've only started researching about alchemy and stuff since you guys have been mentioning it in the group, but I've stumbled across this topic called Ormus.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Great question.
Yeah.
And apparently, it's made by running water through a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Actually, I think there's like three or four ways of making it. But anyway, I was reading about this guy who had been ingesting this water, and it's the before and after pictures and a few in between. But he started out with a white beard because he was, I guess, older. And apparently it remineralized or re-energized his body somehow. He gained all the color into his facial hair as if he were still in his 30s or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it would kind of depend on which method he was using.
That's the monoatomic gold, right, Eric?
Yeah. There's different ways that they claim they're doing it. If he's doing it the way I think he's doing it, then I think it's totally legitimate, although a little different. If he's doing it the way these guys claim that they're producing this substance called Ormus, I would be highly skeptical.
Yeah.
Because he would be anomalous amongst that whole group. Okay, so where Ormus kind of started was Ormes was an acronym for orbitally rearranged. Man, I always forget the last few words, but it had to do with. That's where they get the term monoatomic gold. So
right. This
guy David Hudson was claiming that through his process, you would get kind of a unique molecular structure of gold, and he believed that that was a philosopher's stone. It would turn white, and it would, and that's he claimed it had all these different properties. Now he also claimed that he was trying to do this on an industrial scale, and you know there was this whole conspiracy to shut him down and. There's a question mark there of what he did was actually legitimate, or was it just a big hoax, and did he really even discover anything? I can't make that determination. But what those people now are doing is something called the pH swing method. So they're taking basically salt water, and I think that they are swinging the pH both really low and then back really high using acids and bases. And they have gold in the mix too, I believe. And I've never done the process. I've read about it. And eventually what you get precipitating out is this white powder. And this is what they are calling ormus, with a M-U-S.
Right.
I'm not sure why they changed that. There actually is like an ancient Egyptian god called Ormus, which gives me a little bit of pause, like, okay, who changed this and why?
Mm-hmm.
There are some times they talk about Ormus where it seems they're describing something very similar to the ethers. That's why I was initially kind of hesitant to throw it all out, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, because was Ormus kind of analogous to Oregon or Vortex Energy or something like that? You know, from the experiences people had, sometimes they had initial, they claimed lucid dreams or opening of consciousness or slight physiological changes, and then very quickly those were lost when they ingested this stuff. And you know, so there is some controversy around whether that method, the pH swing method, works. I don't believe it's the Philosopher's Stone in any shape or form. There were some people that were very adamant that it was nothing more than a gold powder. It's kind of an oxide of gold called a calx, and which is pretty easy to make. You don't actually have to do what they are doing. But there are people that claim that they analyzed it and, you know, that it was just a calx of gold. Again, it doesn't really fit in with what the alchemists were talking about in the first place. So in its own right, is it a different process that works? I don't know. But it's definitely not alchemy, okay? Because it doesn't fit the criteria I would lay down. They haven't defined what the mercury is. They aren't doing any of the processes that the alchemists describe. You'd mm-hmm. really have to work hard to kind of fit it in there somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But there was another method, and I actually made one of these devices, and I think that I might revisit that someday. But I think it has more along the lines of the ethers and collecting the ethers than it does anything else, and it's called the vortex traps. And I think that's what you're referring to, Ross, is what they were doing is setting up these magnets in like a tube. And then they were funneling water through it.
Right.
And they would bounce it off a cone and then funnel it back. And supposedly this magnet field that they were creating was like pulling something out of the water.
Mm, yep.
And then they were drinking that water. And the lady that did this, she claimed that she had teeth regrowing. She had huge physiological changes, you know, youth restored and stuff like that. And she got kind of scared and stopped doing it, you know. And she had pictures of this stuff, you know, like form into these white globs and stuff. And so vortex trapping, I think, is more of a legitimate way. The stuff they're describing, they kind of lump it all together and call it ormus. I would not say that's the same substance at all. So vortex trapping, I think, is really interesting. I think the source of water, I was just using tap water because I was living in this little tiny house. And it took me a long time to get enough money to buy all the magnets and make this thing. It worked. And the water that I got from it was, you know, it tasted a little different. I can't claim it really did anything. But I think the source of water was really important. She was working from a stream that was like glacial runoff, and she was using a pump to pump it through her trap. So I think the quality of water you start with is incredibly important. I might have done a step wrong, too, the way I was collecting it. So like I said, you know, I wasn't in a position to buy a pump and live by a stream and pump this stuff out, because it takes a lot of water to do it. Kind of have to let the stuff run. So you're pumping through many, many gallons, and you're getting just a few drops. So I don't know if there's – you mentioned another method. – You said there were three methods? Did I hear you wrong?
I didn't read the details of all of them, but yeah, there's several different setups for it. I think one of them included like a copper pyramid frame and
Okay.
Using
Now, that I'm familiar with, because that's actually kind of one of the first experiments I did. Because if you're going to the site I think you're going to, there was a guy, and he's not doing this anymore. I called him many years ago and talked to him. His name's Josh Gulick.
Yeah, and that was the guy.
Real nice. Is that the guy?
Yeah, okay. That's the name.
And I recreated his experiment, and this is kind of gave credence to the idea there is this fire in the air, and there is this substance in the air that you're trying to at least collect or is present. But what he did is he set up a pyramid in his house in a quiet room, and he had a gold coin in the upper third of the pyramid, which is, I think, typically referred to as the king's chamber or the queen's chamber.
Right.
And then what he got was... my phone is just blowing up right now. Sorry about that. I don't know if you guys can hear it, but...
Yeah, I can.
I got all these crazy noises on it to tell me who's calling, and apparently, right in the middle of the podcast, I got three people that want to talk to me, but...
It's background noise. I can barely hear it.
Okay, that's good. It's just distracting for me because it goes off, and I'm like, who is that? Let me see if I can turn the sound off.
Sounds like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, that's one of my sounds. All right, this is my daughter's school. Try to turn the sound off. Okay, so anyways, so what he did is he put that pure gold coin in there, and what he was getting was like an oil that was forming on there. And he said it was sweet tasting. It was kind of very similar to the oil, that red oil I got when I did that one experiment, except it wasn't red, it was clear. And so I reproduced this experiment. I did it a little differently. I made the vertices out of organite. I made a tetrahedron rather than a pyramid. But I did use a gold coin. I did put it up there, and I did get a little bit of an oil, and eventually it kind of condensed into kind of a white speck. And, you know, I can't tell you what that is. It could have been a condensed salt from the air that we've been describing that eventually, you know, dried out and condensed. I tasted it. Very metallic tasting. Not something I would have expected. I didn't get very much, so tasting it was pretty much... probably not the best scientific thing to do, you know. Hey, what's this? Oh, it's cyanide. Sorry. But, you know.
Anthrax spores.
Yeah. Being younger and, you know, adventurous, you know, I just said, what is this? And so that's kind of where I started, too. I called him and talked to him about his alchemical experience. And because I, you know, at the time I was really excited by his experiment. I'm thinking, hey, you know, ramp this up, get a whole bunch of pyramids, collect this oil, you know, that's the elixir of life. And the reason I got excited about it is that other book, the Rosicrucian Notebook, it describes in there an experiment the Rosicrucians did where they had like this hall of mirrors, these convex mirrors. That would focus sunlight onto a gold sphere in the middle of the room. And then what they would get is this kind of clear oil dripping off of that. And so I hearken back to that experiment. I'm going, man, okay, he did the same thing, but he did it with a pyramid. So in my mind, I thought he had done it. I thought, hey, he made the elixir, you know. All you have to do is figure out how to strengthen it and make it stronger. And I'm not even saying that's wrong. I just don't think that it's very practical to do. Because you don't get very much. And until you... Every alchemist that I've read talks about increasing it in quality and quantity.
Right.
Until you
multiplying it and strengthening it, yeah.
Yep. You figure out what the mercury is, you're not going to be able to do that.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of different ways to do this, but... not all of them are going to be that productive. And so, but yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting experiment, though. It did confirm that there is this
force
or fluid that can
yeah.
be condensed. You know, it's kind of a more subtle than air, but it can be condensed into a liquid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
it's too bad I didn't have more resources, or somebody has more resources, because if you take that and put it in like a mass spectrometer, what would you get out? You know, would it come back as gold? Would it come back as nothing? You know, what would, what's the chemical makeup of that stuff?
I'm sure somebody knows.
you know, that reminds me, we talked about those alternate periodic tables.
Uh-huh. Or at least
Walter Russell's periodic table, the one that looks like a snake, you know, zigzagging down or winding
spiral
back and forth.
Yeah.
He believed, and I've only glanced this, so I don't know the details exactly of it, but he believed that once you got down to that densest element at the bottom, which was, I think it was uranium, maybe plutonium.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, uranium was the densest non-synthetic element, and I think it was just an isotope of that. But anyway, he believed that, I don't know if it was that the radiation that comes off of that type of element, or just because it's so dense, he believed that it broke down and it released vapors of the very first element in his periodic table, which was like 20 before hydrogen.
Hmm.
It was something he called Alphanon, and it was so fine, such a fine vapor or element that, you know, it was, I don't know, you know, what state of matter he considered it. You know, maybe it was an ether, or maybe it was just, I really don't know, but.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Cater kind of describes that as kind of an infinite regression of different levels of this ether. Like, it, there's all these different combinations. So it's not outside of really what I've read about. I mean, it's entirely possible that what he's describing is both real and not just theoretical, based on what some of these other guys have theorized, you know.
Yeah.
But what you're bringing up with uranium brings me to another subject, which is kind of an obscure guy out there, Art Kunkin. Chris, have you heard of him?
Yes. Yep.
Did you buy that book, by the way?
No, I couldn't find it. I couldn't find, like, it's not. It's like really hard to find now. His website's down and everything.
You know, I just recently condensed all my files into one computer because I had stuff scattered over like three computers, and I spent like a whole day over Christmas break just throwing things away, condensing things, you know, like, oh, here's a resume from 25 years ago. Do I need that anymore? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I know I have that book somewhere, so if I run across it, I'll send it to you. But
yeah.
Art Kunkin came out with a book a few years ago. It's not very long. And he was pretty well known, I think, within kind of the, I hate to label somebody like as a hippie, but that's kind of what he was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Free press, I guess, is a better term. He's in California, and he was producing a newsletter. I think he had some popularity. It was mostly about social issues and that kind of thing. But he was a trained alchemist, and he got into I'm forgetting where he trained at. But if you look up Art Kunkin, you can kind of look at his biography. Like I said, I'm not very good at the whole biography. But his premise was that he believed the Philosopher's Stone could be manifested inside of a medium, something like fruit, through using radiation.
Right.
So what his book outlines is how to take these radioactive stones, like that are forms of uranium. There are different things you can buy on the internet. One's called uraninite. That's probably the most common one. There are several different rocks that produce small level or low levels of radiation as they decay, and they're legal to own and that kind of thing. But they do require some care if you're a collector of. There are gemologists and rock hounds out there that collect these, and you learn about how to store them, because they'll produce radon, and you don't want to ingest any of the dust that gets on them or anything like that, just for, you know, safety reasons of cancer. But what he was doing is taking these stones and then kind of having a shield over the top of them and then placing fruit on top and allowing that radiation to bathe these apples or oranges or whatever you're going to eat. And he claimed that that was the secret to alchemy. And what I found interesting about it, though, is that I believe it actually works. I don't think it's the stone, but it's definitely the prime materia. See, what you're doing is, one of the things you'll learn through some of these books that I've pointed out is that Akasha or the ethers, kind of hard to move. It's so subtle that when you move your hand through the air, you're not moving it. It's right. Going right through you. It's so fine that the spaces between your atoms, it's just fitting right through there, you know? Yep. So one of the few things that moves this is electromagnetic fields.
Right.
And so the whole idea there is that if you have a radioactive rock that's decaying, it's producing gamma rays, it's producing X-rays, you've got beta radiation, which isn't really going to really do much, and alpha particles too. But it's really those electromagnetic rays that are being produced that would push that ether away from a radioactive material. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of evidence that we need a certain level of radiation to even live. I mean, there were some experiments done by Russian scientists that took chick embryos and shielded them from all background radiation. And these chicks didn't develop properly. You know, they ended up being deformed.
It'll collect in the fruit, kind of like an orgone accumulator.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. And mm-hmm. and the whole idea there is that water, again, Wilhelm Reich talked about this. You know, he talked about water being a collector for the ethers. It's drawn to the ethers.
Yep.
Reverse that. The ethers are drawn to water.
Right.
So he
right.
was making these things called cloud busters to break up, you know, these negative zones and to bring the ethers back into these dead zones. I might have to get a drink of water here. Whole idea then was to push that ether, and I don't know if Kunkin really put two and two together. I think he was talking about just the radiation itself,
right?
Was doing something to the apple, you know?
Right.
But I talked to a physicist. You know, I'm one of these guys that's going to call up somebody. You know, so one of the guys that was selling uraninite, I got his phone number, and he was a physicist doing his own private research. And man, this guy was talking way over my head. But what I wanted to find out, what wasn't very clear, was if I set something down next to something radioactive, is it going to become radioactive? You know, I don't want to eat a radioactive apple.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no, of course not. The source of radiation is from the rock itself, from the decay. You know, and he described the different kinds of particles that come out. Even with my background in science, I didn't know that much, you know. So I was like, okay, that makes sense. And he's like, so it could sit there indefinitely. It's not, you know, in his mind, it's not going to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I'm thinking, hey, this could be an ether collector.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, I had some really interesting experiments. Experiences, I should say. You know, I bought some of those stones. I put some apples around them and ate them for about a month. I rotated them through, you know. And I was very cautious about, you know, washing everything, washing my hands, making sure they were stored properly. You know, I don't store them inside. I don't recommend anybody do this. I mean, unless you're prepared to go learn about radioactive stones and how to properly store them, don't go do this.
You should You should explain why, just so people.
Okay, yeah, well, there's dangers there, okay? Number one, these stones eventually can produce a radioactive gas called radon, so you can breathe that. Number two, if these rocks get on your skin or anything, that's not dangerous, but if you then ingest something that has this dust on it from the stone, then you have ionizing radiation that's now in close to your soft organs. Usually the skin, if you're just around these stones, any ionizing radiation coming off of it is going to be blocked by your skin. You're not going to really get any appreciable radiation damage from just being around them, unless you sleep next to them or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you shouldn't do that either, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So just making sure that you're washing everything very thoroughly so that you're not accidentally ingesting something and then, you know, getting cancer 20 years down the road. So there are precautions to take, and unless you're prepared to do that, you know, again, I'm doing it for experimental purposes. I'm not out here advocating do this for health reasons or anything.
Right.
But I did have some really unusual experiences after eating these apples for a few weeks. And I don't know why I stopped. I think I just got more interested in other things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was a time where I just kind of had this real subtle energy. Like, it's almost like I couldn't get tired.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept me up for 2 days. I mean, literally, it was like, you know, 4 a.m. And I'm not tired. I don't feel wired. It's not like coffee that kind of gives you an artificial boost of energy.
Right.
And then wears off and you have this crash.
Right.
It just didn't wear off. You know, I just wasn't tired.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of mellowed me out, too. I mean, it did have an effect on my emotions. I was not very excitable. I mean, I was just kind of, you know. And it lasted about a day and a half. And so, you know, I got sleepy the next day about the normal time. And I went to bed and I didn't have any ill effects from it or anything. So very unusual experience. One of the other things I noticed too is some of the apples, even in the middle of winter, their seeds would sprout and start to grow inside the apple if I left them out there for a couple weeks being exposed to this radiation.
Mm.
So I found that interesting. I'm not sure that happens if you just store apples in your garage. At least I don't recall ever seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
When you cut open an apple, have you ever seen one sprouted?
No.
So I thought that was interesting too.
Mm.
So I think, you know, I think it illustrates that there are these kind of unknown little experiments you can do and verify that at least some of what these fringe guys were doing has some validity.
Yeah.
Now, can I interject?
Yeah, go ahead.
You say that it's only, you shouldn't, like it wouldn't have the effect, you need to mediate it through like something edible, like a fruit or
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that has to do with photosynthesis? You said not to sleep
no,
near your head.
No, I think what's going on there, Ross, is...
collects an organic matter.
It collects an organic matter, so you could collect it in yourself, but
yep.
The downside is you're also being exposed to ionizing radiation.
Yep.
Whereas the fruit is, it's already, you know, quote unquote dead. It's not really dead, but it's not, you know, it's not a living being. Once you eat it, you know, you're going to get the benefits from whatever it's collected without having the ionization being pointed at you, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, do you want to sit around a radioactive rock for, you know, 2 weeks hoping it has some benefit? Let the apple do the work for you, if that makes sense.
Or the suffering, whatever it actually
yeah,
might produce.
Exactly.
both Cater and Reich both talked about that, how it collects and, you know, like Reich would build, I forget what it's uh-huh. called, but he would build, well, he'd build an orgone accumulator, you know, and it'd be like layers of organic material and then like layers of metal or wood
yep.
or whatever, you know.
Right.
And so, somehow it collects in that and gets trapped in there, I guess. I mean...
Yeah, and that actually kind of spawned a little cottage industry. If you go to Etsy or if you go to some of these guys' websites, they're selling this stuff called Organite,
yeah.
which is metal shavings with some kind of resin,
yep.
an organic resin, usually fiberglass. And then they, you know, they... make them little pyramids or little muffin tin shapes, you know.
Yep.
That was popularized by a guy named Don Croft. And so this term organite kind of came from Wilhelm Reich's.
Mm-hmm.
There's some interesting little side stories about organite. But one of the things that Don Croft's website showed you how to make was something called a cloud buster. And so you make
yeah.
this bucket full of organite, and then you have these copper rods sticking out through the top and pointed at the sky, and it's supposed to make the weather around your house better.
Yep. I'll actually dissipate clouds.
Right, right.
Cater talked about too in his book.
It can do either. It can either cause cloud formation if there's what Reich called door, which is kind of a dead state.
Right.
Or it could dissipate clouds that were not supposed to be there. You
right.
know? So it could have either effect, really. But they call them cloud busters. Well, he called his chem busters because he's of the opinion that people are spraying
chemtrails
on us. And then he claims if you set these things up above you, then it dissipates the chemtrails.
Right.
So kind of interesting. Can't get more fringe than that one right there.
Why do you think that it accumulates in that?
In fruit?
Well, in fruit or organic matter, why do you think it? I mean, does it get trapped in there, or why does it accumulate?
I have thought a little bit about that. Yeah, the number one, I think it's because of the water. I think that your water is a natural collector.
Okay.
You already mentioned Reich, and you already mentioned Cater. Both mentioned that.
Yeah.
But the other thing too is that if you look at something like an apple is, and when I say the word cell, I'm not talking about microscopic cells. Now I'm talking about they're like these little pockets. If you look at an apple with a magnifying glass, it kind of has these little pockets of flesh,
Mm-hmm.
And so there's it's almost kind of creating a little orgone accumulator just through its own nature.
Yep.
And so I think that you have that combination there of the water and the actual physical structure. There's a lot to be said about shapes and how they affect our environment. We've already kind of mentioned the pyramid and the tetrahedron. That fire that we're talking about, interestingly enough, has made it into our language. Pyramid means fire. The pyre.
Right, yeah.
I think it's like an old English derivation.
And pyramids have very interesting properties.
Yeah, they do. I mean,
like they would, there's one account where they went into one of the great pyramids, I don't remember which, but they found a cat in there. A cat got in there somehow and it was dead. And mm-hmm. it was not decaying. It was preserved.
Right. There are people that have had experiences just with pyramids set up in their home that have had that same experience.
Yeah.
Where they're able to not really fossilize, but preserve food longer.
Yep.
The guy that wrote the book, Patrick Flanagan, wrote a pyramid power book back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he claims if you orient it right and do all the right things and have the right material, that you can keep fruit from rotting. You can basically kind of have a dehydrator that's made out of a pyramid, but you're not dehydrating. It's kind of naturally dehydrating.
Yeah.
It's just your fruit's not rotting.
Right.
Kind of interesting. So, did we kind of finish the whole? I guess we did.
I got another question, actually, if you want to.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, this kind of gets into philosophy a little bit with this whole alchemy thing. So, and this is something I struggled with a lot. You probably remember, Eric.
Yeah. That's
basically if this is all if this is true, okay, if we accept this premise that transmutation is possible,
right?
I mean, what kind of implications does that have for like pantheism or because Christians traditionally usually believe in creation ex nihilo, which means creation out of nothing.
Yeah.
Which isn't even explicitly taught in the Bible, but it's it's the historical church position, so it's usually what they hold. So what are your thoughts on that? Just kind of the implications of this if this is true.
Yeah. You and I have talked a little bit about it. I mean, I think one of the things that you could conclude is that this substrate or ether is real. Does it proceed out of God, or is it something that he created Ex Nihilo. I think that's right. Where you mm-hmm. kind of get to the point of deducing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you... So if it proceeds from him, then he's not really creating Ex Nihilo.
I would say it is interesting, though, how you pretty much have in the mythologies of, you know, all the ancient world, you don't have creation Ex Nihilo, you know.
Right.
You have some sort of emanationism.
Right.
So.
Right. And even, you know, you look at, like, Buddhism, you know, it proceeds out of the belly of Brahman, you know,
yeah.
the whole creation.
And I would just say, from dialoguing with Eric about this, there is a solution where you could still have, you know, because this gets into problems like monism and, you know, how do we distinguish, you know, matter if there's no real distinctions, you know, if everything's just different degrees of, you know, this one substance. I kind of came up with, there is a solution to this, you know, you don't have to fall into this, because I think it's a false dilemma, fallacy, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, God could still have placed, you know, these absolute distinctions on matter, even if he created everything out of the same matter. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Distinctions can exist as these, you know, propositions that exist in his mind that are these abstract yeah. propositions, but they're real, and he placed them on the matter. You know, so that's what makes the distinctions, you know.
Right. Right.
So you can solve that problem, you know. You don't have to fall into pantheism, you know.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and I think that's where people fall. I mean, I was actually talking to this spiritual alchemist the other night, and you know, everything he was describing, I kept saying back and forth to him, everything you're describing doesn't preclude the physical. You keep saying this is spiritual, but everything you're describing is describing the matter that I've been studying about for 20 years.
Right.
You know, you aren't telling me something that's not material. You keep using material experiences to explain something that, you know, you keep saying is spiritual,
mm-hmm.
but you're confusing that term, spiritual. He was misdefining spiritual,
because mm-hmm.
really, by its definition, it means immaterial.
Right.
But he kept talking about this force that binds us all and can be manipulated. I'm like, well, then it's physical. It's not spiritual.
Yeah.
You know? So it really comes down to good definitions. I mean, this is why Chris and I spend a lot of time talking about theology, how to think properly, presuppositionalism,
mm-hmm.
Because even approaching a subject like alchemy, it becomes very useful on, you know, how I form a theory. And, you know, we were talking about Sherlock Holmes the other day, and everybody talks about Sherlock Holmes, you know, his powers of deduction. And we were like, well, that's not powers of deduction, it's powers of induction.
Right.
You know, he has all this data, all these particular pieces of data, and then he's making theoretical jumps other people can't make because he's got better inductive data, but it's still
inductive.
You know, kind of it's still inductive.
Circular,
it's still a bottom-up approach. You know, you're trying to gather all these particulars and make general assumptions. And, you know, there's very little true deduction that really happens except in the field of logic, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean,
I gotta say, that is what distinguished alchemy in its original form that was written by these medieval alchemists, is they straight up said, you know, we receive this either by written tradition or oral tradition, or God revealed this to us.
Yep. Or somebody taught
deduced
me,
from,
you know.
Yeah. I mean, they were deducing from
manuscript.
Yeah, they were deducing from axioms that had been revealed to them, you know, a priori. You know, it was deduction. It wasn't inductive. It wasn't any kind of fallacious science, you know, that's done today.
And, you know, I kind of used, not even knowing I was using it, but I kind of used a presuppositional approach to this topic, you know, when I first started investigating, which is, you know, I had to assume that what they were saying was real. And then I had to also assume that certain practitioners weren't hoaxers, or they were talking about something they knew about, you know. So I tried to weed out the people that were speculative and the people that sounded like they had actually done it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I studied those guys. Mm-hmm. And Fulcanelli is probably the alchemist that helped me the most. But you have to read it over and over again. You have to go over it and then try to figure out, okay, what did he mean by that? And unfortunately, induction is only going to get you so far, and experimentation is only going to get you so far. Let's take the example of the mercury. Well, there's an infinite amount of substances you can try. But if you use the symbolism to try and narrow that number down and then take some accurate guesses on what operation they were using, you know, with a couple of pieces of luck, you can probably make some headway. at least that's my experience. I mean, I think that they have
I think you're using a lot of deduction, though, and
true,
revelation, and I mean, because if we're going strictly off induction, I would contend that you can't make any headway. Because you can't even know that you've made headway. So think about deduction or induction, because you know it gets into probabilities, and that's a fraction. You know, it's one over infinity. There's an infinite number of possible variables.
Right.
So there would be no way you could know that you're even gaining headway. You'd already have to know the whole, you know.
Study helps, because when you arrive at something that you didn't notice before, but you have a lot of particular pieces of knowledge from different authors, there are aha moments where you're like, okay, that meets every condition of what they've described, no matter who I read. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, why is it called mercury? Is it because it has a mercurial look to it? It's also called the mirror of our art. I believe the mercury has a silvery quality to it. But that's why people get common mercury and this mercurial substance confused. The mercury is also described as a water that doesn't wet the hands. It's described sometimes as a white smoke. So can this mercury take on different forms? Is it different states? Does it look differently in different states? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there's possibilities there, and you kind of have to... I think that you can learn a lot from studying the alchemists in terms of what they did, because I've found the only two things they really hide are the nature and location of their mercury,
mm-hmm,
and the specifics of their operation.
Right. Temperatures and whatnot.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think there's little jelly beans in there to even help you with those things.
Yeah.
And the reason I think that is because, you know, somebody like Fulcanelli, he'll come to a point and he'll say, I've said too much. You know? And he'll point at things for you. He'll say, well, I'd like to break this Gordian knot for you, but I'm not going to go any further, you know? Mm. And so it makes you stop and contemplate, okay, what did he say previously that made him regret, you know, going this far?
Mm-hmm.
What was he revealing there?
Mm-hmm.
I like those kind of clues. And, you know, I think if you really, you know, don't buy the book Idiot's Guide to Alchemy or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think if you really want to start with a book that is going to be, if you were to come through our whole podcast to the end here and say, what's one book I should buy? I would buy The Mystery of the Cathedrals. Mm-hmm. I think that it has enough for everybody. If you have just a cursory interest in some of the symbolism, if you want to know what alchemy is about, he does a good job of describing that. And it's even for the person that really wants to get deep into it. And it's something you'll read over and over again, because you read it once and you're like, okay, I retained maybe, you know, a 16th of that. Let me go back and read it again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a fascinating book on the topic. And, you know, I would not maybe buy as your second book the Dwellings of the Philosophers. It's kind of the same concept. There's a theory that Fulcanelli didn't write that second book, but I think he did. It's just more complete, and it doesn't just talk about the churches, the few churches that The Mystery of the Cathedrals does. He talks about all these little alchemical dwellings in France, and so he goes through them, like the Castle of Dampierre and The salamander of Lucix.
I got another question.
Correctly. Yeah, go ahead.
What do you think happened to these medieval Christian alchemists, and who do you think were building these structures that clearly reflect knowledge of alchemical principles?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not even sure I know, Chris, the answer to either one of those.
Well, because I think you can infer a couple of things from the writings, because they were basically saying, like, we're being hunted. You know, like,
yeah.
There were people out to get them, you know, that was another reason why they used such coded language.
Yeah, I mean, going away from the conspiratorial for a second, let's just say you lived back in that time and you had this knowledge. There were kings that would want to kill you from producing gold because that would hurt their economy.
Right.
There are kings that would want to capture you to make gold for them and basically hold you captive.
Which happened a couple times.
Happened quite a few times.
Yep.
Even if you were a charlatan, you know, they didn't know you were a charlatan. They would still capture you and try to maybe torture you and find out what you know. That's another possibility, is they would just take you and threaten you and torture you until you divulged what you knew, and then they'd kill you anyways.
Mm-hmm.
The Rosicrucian notebook, I think, tells a couple of those stories of persecution, too. There is another reason that for secrecy, which is Fulcanelli definitely elaborates the fact that they did not want to give this to the common man for a lot of different reasons. You know, they didn't believe the common man was virtuous enough. Yeah.
Yep.
And so they hid it from the layman because there were inherent dangers for somebody who didn't appreciate the knowledge.
Well, they were operating off clear, biblical principles there. I mean, they were assuming the fallen, wicked nature of man, the majority of people are going to abuse this, so we don't want to make a bunch of wicked reprobates immortal. That's probably a bad idea. I mean, that was the whole thing about why, Yahweh expelled Adam and Eve from eating the tree of life after they fell into sin. He didn't want immortal sinners. You know what I mean?
Right.
Kind of the same thing going on there.
With knowledge like that, you could do great good, but you could also do great evil. So I think they recognize that, and that was another impetus for them hiding their knowledge. But who built the cathedrals, though? That's a really good question, because I think that brings back in the conspiratorial.
That's what I mean. Saying it seems like at one point Christians had this knowledge, and somehow things got reversed. And I mean, basically, what I said earlier, it sounds like the wicked reprobates got a hold of this. They have the keys of this knowledge now, which isn't good.
Curiously, they have probably the same reasons for not divulging this information.
Yeah.
A little less altruistic.
They would have the reverse. I guess if you would assume that if they're Satanists, they probably hate, both Christians and non-Christians, but they really want it out of the hands of Christians.
Right. It kind of depends, I guess, on your view of history and whether your view is correct on who made those cathedrals. The other possibility is that whoever commissioned those cathedrals knew nothing, but the builders did, and they were just like, kind of wink, wink, nod, nod, I'm going to throw this in there. That's another possibility. Not a possibility you apparently agree with, but I'm just saying.
No. All right, well, Ross.
I can always tell when Chris doesn't agree with me, because I hear this groan, like...
You guys have any other questions, or...?
I asked a bunch, Jorge or Jorgie. If you have any, go ahead.
Jorge.
I mean, I've been writing a lot of stuff down, but I'm not really sure if there's anything I'm really questioning too much.
Well, questions help because they're kind of a springboard for discussion, you know, like when you asked about Ormus or something, that brings up a whole other subject that is related to alchemy but isn't necessarily part of alchemy, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
I could read some of the properties if you want.
If these guys are, you know, don't have anything new, I mean, we're a little over 2 hours now, probably more than that.
I did have one last question, if can.
That's fine. Yeah.
I kind of brought this up in the group, but the astrological pairings between planets and certain metals.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's a great question.
Can you go deeper into that? Like, are those bodies made of those metals, or is it that the frequency of their light waves are? You know, how are they linked, and why are they linked? It's more than mythological, you said. It's more than just stories that were made up about the gods.
Right.
So,
right.
You know.
Well, there's definitely an association between, you know, they call them the planetary metals.
Yep.
You know, copper is associated with Venus. Iron is associated with Mars. Gold is associated with the sun. Silver, the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Mercury with Mercury. That one's always pretty easy to remember. Yeah. tin, I forget which one tin is.
I think tin is Jupiter and lead is Saturn.
Tin. Mm-hmm. Yes. And the Saturn connection is a confusing one because they'll talk about Saturn quite a bit. And that's why some people get kind of locked into trying to use lead in their experiments because they'll associate Saturn with lead. And for that same reason, the way people get locked into using gold in their, because they'll assume gold, as I did, is associated with the sun. So when they're talking about the marriage of the sun and the moon, they're not really referring to the metals there. You know, they're going back to their same old tricks, you know, with the mercury and the sulfur, because mercury is also associated with the moon. And I think through my own speculation, it has a silvery quality to it in one of its states. whereas sulfur is associated with the sun.
Fiery.
For a couple of different reasons. It's fiery, it's red in nature, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this marriage of they call it the marriage of the red man and the white wife.
Yep.
It's another way to kind of express that. So in terms of their energy or why they associated these metals to these planets, you know, that I don't really know. I think you're closer to having the answer there, just off the top of my head, with their energy.
Frequencies.
The frequencies that are associated with them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there are people that use metals as they do stones. They think that they have a auric field or an energy associated with them, and so they have properties, both positive and negative, associated with them for healing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And those planets are associated with those energies.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best answer I could give you. I've actually speculated about that myself, but I haven't run across that much in the alchemists explaining that. They just state it,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I don't know if that's very helpful.
I got a question.
Shoot.
So you, with the mercury and the sulfur, you kind of have this dualism of like a masculine and a feminine element.
Mm-hmm.
So are these two offshoots of a single substance? Like, is it how this single substance manifests, is in like a masculine and a feminine, you know, kind of like polarity?
Yeah. That's a great question. I think so is the best answer I can give you.
Mm-hmm.
Because the two together make the rebus, okay? Mm-hmm. The two thing, the celestial child, it ends up making the philosophic stone. or the philosophical Mercury. Okay.
Yeah.
So, what is going on there? I mean, you're obviously taking two aspects, and that's something I'm not going to hide. The alchemists talk about these substances as being locked into the metals. Okay. That's not a secret.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, but there's a lot of metals that you could play around with.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not sure I'm helping anybody there.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I've come to the opinion that this is a concentrated substance, and you're artificially creating it. Because they talk about philosophical gold, okay? It's not real gold. It's artificial gold. You've artificially combined an aspect of gold that's both male and female and created a semblance of what gold has in it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The purity of both the sulfur and the mercury seems to be important.
Mm.
Because sometimes these substances of mercury and sulfur are not easy to separate from their impure roots, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not lead, okay, but I'm going to use the example of lead. The alchemists talk about these substances having both a mercury and a sulfur in them. Its highest manifestation is in gold.
Right, right.
So if you knew how to draw the sulfur of gold, or the sulfur out of gold easily, you could make the stone left and right.
Right.
According to the alchemists.
Right.
But what they say is that gold is extremely locked up. It's a closed book.
Yeah, you got to use the lesser stones first.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, so what they are describing then is a process of making this substance artificially.
Mm-hmm.
So, is it two different aspects? I mean, is it a negative spin and a positive spin, and you're
right,
kind of merging them together and making the original matter? You know, I think that's the best guess, right?
Well, I got to say, because there is a lot of, I mean, just historical and precedent and traditions as well for that. Like even we mentioned Walter Russell. He even talks about how the two primary forces of the universe are, you know, electrostatic and electromagnetic. There's like a charging and a discharging. You know, it's a masculine and a feminine.
Well, I think you're going to find that dualism everywhere.
I know. You look
in Taoism.
There's even a verse in the Book of Sirach that says, I mean, it flat out says God created everything in opposites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
yeah, you know, a lot of the Taoist teachings, you know, there's a huge focus on the yin and the yang, and
yeah,
and then trying to combine those or at least balance them.
Mm-hmm.
Internal alchemy is all based on that.
Mm-hmm.
Is not only moving the chi, but how to balance it, because they saw it as kind of two different flavors, you know.
Right.
One's too hot. If you go to an acupuncturist, that's primarily what they're doing. They're trying to determine where you have too much heat and where you're too cold, and then they'll balance those out. Mm-hmm. And they use different substances. You know, my daughter one time had tonsillitis, and we took her to an acupuncturist. It was amazing what this guy did. He's like, well, okay, so the tonsils, he wasn't talking about physical problems at all. Well, she's got an infection.
Right.
He saw it as a heat that was over abundant there. You take away the heat, you take away the source of power or whatever for the bad bacteria, you know?
See, isn't that interesting? They're talking about more subtle causes that precede the chemical effects.
And so I was really surprised at what was, you know, contained in this little capsule that he wanted me to give my daughter. It had like talc in it. I'm talking the rock talc, okay? And you know, and he explained to me, he's like, well, you know, these substances draw down the heat from the upper part of the body down to the lower part of the body, and that's what we're trying to do. But he was also using, you know, kind of this electric acupuncture to try and open up her meridians to make sure the energy was flowing well too. So, you know, because their idea was that the energy was stuck in one area and you needed to get it to flow out.
Right.
And I'll tell you, it worked. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
She never had her tonsils out. She was feeling better within just a few days. Mm-hmm. Now, some people could say, well, that was psychosomatic or whatever, you know. Yeah, I can't prove that that was because of that, but it's hard to tell, you know, an 8-year-old the process of Taoism is working on her, you know, so I don't think it was psychosomatic.
No, no.
But still, I mean, I found it really interesting because I didn't know much about, you know, that kind of medicine at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the reasons for it made sense to me. It wasn't as hocus pocus as people make it out to be, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
It had a real reason behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that's the best guess, Chris, to answer your question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know we've talked about some of this stuff, and so I appreciate you bringing it up because, you know, I forget. Maybe I'm getting senile in my old age. I need some of that elixir, man.
Yeah.
Regenerate my brain.
Well, I was going to say, too, you know, when I was really into Gnosticism, the Valentinian Gnosticism, they actually, their whole cosmogony system is, you know, in terms of the emanations, they believe that everything emanated out of God in what they called syzygies.
Uh-huh.
It's a really weird word they had, but basically just means pairs. You know, like for every emanation, there was a male and a female.
That's interesting.
So, mm-hmm.
You kind of have to look at that in the same way you look at mythology. I mean, you know, religions of the world, they retain, you know, vestiges of the truth.
Yeah.
And I think with Christianity, what you have is kind of the polar opposite. You've lost some of the other aspects, but you've retained the most important aspects of truth.
Yeah.
You know, the resurrection of Christ and who the true God is and where your focus should be is really the most important aspects of religion, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, all of our presuppositional thought stems from the idea that there are moral absolutes, there are logical absolutes, and there's a consistency to the physical laws of nature that all stem from a creator.
Yeah, which can only be justified by a creator who revealed them, you know, to us.
Right. When we expand out and we see the most logical evidence for that in the historical writings of the Bible,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, what does the Bible teach? Focus on Christ, you know. It doesn't say that you put, you know, amethyst in your pocket because it has energy.
Right.
I think in relative terms, God has given us the most important things, but for some reason, the Christian community has kind of lost touch with these other things,
mm-hmm.
and that are more esoteric.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Well, I mean, that are even alluded to in the Bible, you know?
Right, right. I mean,
so,
you know, I was just thinking
today, like transmutation, like with the Egyptian magicians,
uh-huh.
for, you know, mimicking Moses' feet of the, you know, the staff turning into a serpent. I mean, that's transmutation.
Right.
That's transmutation.
Well, there is this thing called the Moses path. I'm glad you brought that up, because I wouldn't have thought about it unless you mentioned that. And supposedly what the Moses path was, and they're extrapolating this from the story of Moses and Aaron destroying the golden calf.
Oh, yeah, making the colloidal gold.
Yeah, mixing the gold and making everybody drink it,
yeah.
Okay? Well, there is an alchemical path that uses gold and common mercury, and you put it into a crucible that's really tight, and you bury it, and then there's different ideas of the transmutative properties of the Moses path. I mean, the actual methodology, I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, that it's not just common mercury. They were trying to change the common mercury into something else and then put it in with gold. So that I don't think is a legitimate path. I mean, I've read about it, and there's nothing in it that I've really seen that you know, I've never heard of anybody claiming it worked.
Right.
I've heard of people trying it and claiming it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that claim it does work, but you're missing an ingredient, and they purposely leave it out.
I see, yeah.
And that's another thing we didn't really talk about, which is, you know, one of the reasons I like Fulcanelli is he says, I'm not going to lie to you. Okay. Mm-hmm. He says, I'll omit things. I won't talk about certain things.
Right.
But I'm not going to lie. And there are alchemists out there that are not as inclined. They will just lie.
Yeah.
Or they will purposely
lead you down a false path. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They'll purposely lead you down a false path. Or they'll leave out a key ingredient and not even point to it and say, I'm leaving this out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Fulcanelli doesn't do that. He lays it out. He just says, I'm not going to tell you everything.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to stop here, you know. Mm. And so that's another reason I've come to love those writings. But, you know, I've gleaned some good tidbits here and there in Pursuit of Gold Alchemy in Theory and Practice. That's a collection of several different manuscripts. It has a kind of a question and answer with Paracelsus in it. Here, let me see if I can find that real quick, because I think you guys will get a sense of... It sounds like doublespeak.
Mm-hmm.
So, here, listen to this. How has this humidity been named by the philosophers? Answer, Mercury. By what is it governed? By the rays of the sun and the moon. What is the second matter? The warmth of the earth, otherwise the dry heat, which is termed sulfur by the philosophers. What therefore should be done? The matter must be effectively separated from its impurities, for there is no metal, how pure soever, which is entirely freed from imperfections, through their extent varies. Now all superfluities, cortices, and scoria must be peeled off and purged from out of the matter in order to discover its seed. Remember I was saying earlier about how purity is important?
Yep.
So there's something I learned there, and not necessarily from this particular passage, but this is the kind of stuff that Paracelsus kind of goes through. And it all sounds like a giant riddle. But you figure out a little key, and that'll unlock some things. So when I read this now, I'm not totally befuddled by what he's saying.
Uh-huh.
You know? It makes sense to me.
Uh-huh.
What should receive the most careful attention of the philosophers? Answer. Assuredly, the end of nature. And this is to be by no means looked for in the vulgar metals.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now that seems contradictory than what we just said. But these having issued already from the hands of the fashioner, it is no longer found there. For what precise reason? Because the vulgar metals, and chiefly gold, are absolutely dead, while ours, on the contrary, are absolutely living and possess a soul. What is the life of the metals? It is no other substance than fire, when they are as yet embedded in the mines. What is their death? Their life and death are in reality one principle, for they die as they live, by fire, but their death is by fire of fusion. After what manner are metals conceived in the womb of the earth? When the four elements have developed their power or virtue in the center of the earth and have deposited their seed, nature, in the course of a distillatory process, sublimes them superficially by the warmth and energy of perpetual movement. I'm going to stop there, but you can see that, you know, that sounds confusing, because here I am saying, oh, it's found in the metals. Well, I think to solve that problem for you guys, there are substances in the metals that you're trying to draw out.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So he's saying, really, in the metals in their entirety are not to be used.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's also a possibility that you start there, not necessarily with the metals, but what you're drawing out of them. And this is really something I haven't solved yet, is you go back to that word magnesia I was talking about, okay? This magnet, this flesh magnet, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Are you creating something that draws out of the air, or are you creating something that's from inside the metals, okay? It's not a problem I've solved. It could be both, to be honest with you. So, just a theory, but I think that is what he is talking about there, is they all talk about not using metal, but talking about using mineral substances. And I think there's a reason for that. It's almost kind of a blind, you know. It's a partial truth. Well, it's not really metal, but... This is the end of part one of our alchemy podcast. The audio was getting kind of late, and we were having some technical problems, but we anticipate having an alchemy part two, so if you've enjoyed that, you know, we'll make another one. Thanks for listening. This is Outlaw Nation on the Fringe Radio Network. You can reach us at outlawnation7@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment there at Fringe Radio Network.
You are listening to the Outlaw Nation on the Fringe Radio Network. FringeRadioNetwork.com. I don't know.